Random House Audiobooks presents Secrets of a Sparrow by Diana Ross. Read for you by the author.
Secrets of a Sparrow. My tapestry of life. I want to share my thoughts and feelings from where I am today. In the middle, looking forward to tomorrow and touching on the past as it relates to where I am today. I look back with a gentle heart, full of love, remembering the good times. This will be a sentimental journey to very special places, not chasing shadows. I love life fiercely and desperately. I've always had a gift of seeing the good bits. I had lots of fun. It was wonderful. A land of dreams. A throw of the dice. I was extremely lucky. A perfectionist because it was and is important. I have very high standards for myself, and I've worked hard. Of all I do, I'm most proud of my children. They make me happy. I am truly fortunate to have great friends. I'm completely devoted to my friends and those close to me. Determination has been the best element of my career. I demand the best of myself. I crunch, I studied more than what was expected. I also had many struggles, inward and outward. Being a mother, a wife, a feminist, being black and female, a performer, having my own business, being strong and decisive, being sad and sometimes afraid, all makes for a complex life. If I could change anything in this world, it would be to have no racial prejudice and no hatred of any sort. I've learned many lessons, and I'm so grateful. Time has been strange for me. Memories are diffused, confused, and have also been misused. It's all happened so fast. Maybe writing will help me find my youth. It's been a long and joyous career. I've been in the public eye since the 60s. 30 years you've watched me grow up. I'm looking back on a very innocent time, and I find it difficult to turn back the clock. Some might find it easy to escape and retreat into remembrance of golden days. I find it hard to sit evaluating and judging the past. Secrets of a Sparrow maybe will give you a tiny bit of insight into my heart. This is my 30th year in music, and so my memoirs seem timely. My survival was because of my optimism, faith, belief, and trust in what is good and true, and for being forgiving. I won't try to explain everything. I can't explain it. Nobody can explain it. So I reach into my bag of miracles, and I pull out a memory. Thanks for your support. At 6 p.m. on Thursday, July 21st, 1983, the weather outside seemed completely calm, but inside my body, I was an electrical force bursting with energy. I wore a multicolored African robe. The opening of the show was to relate to my roots. Pictures were projected on a huge screen from the African jungle, interspersed with New York City, in itself another kind of jungle. I stood on the stairs adjacent to the huge platform stage. This was no normal stage. It was a manifested figment of my imagination, and I was about to step into a dream I had spent more than a year conceiving and planning. Thousands of details. It had been grueling, like building a city from scratch. But what a city it was to be. A city of great intensity and light. A city of creativity and vitality. A city that would eventually bring joy to the children. I'm a dreamer. And that's what I did in Central Park. I picked a dream, a goal, and then imagined all the details, drew it up like a blueprint, designed it, and then I knew it would happen. I believe that existence is magical, that we can think of something and bring it into being. The sky looked crystal clear, at least from where I was standing. The weather was made to order. How could it have been more perfect? The energy in Central Park was electrified, sensual, alive with the heartbeats of the people. I could feel their beauty and excitement. All 400,000 of them. We were gathered together to have a good time, to dance. They wanted to move with me and to allow the music to move through them. I could feel it, and I intended to do my best to get them what they wanted. It was an honor. And ultimately, my dream of a place in New York City where kids could play would happen. The concert was to be free. We hoped that hats, T-shirts, poster and banner sales could create a sponsorship for a playground, a secure place where children could play, run, laugh, and meet other children, a place to be safe in the magical time of childhood. The African drums started vibrating their compelling beat, the music rose, and the Bernice Johnson dancers began doing their thing. While I straightened the fringe of my jacket, my mind flashed a picture of Belle Isle, a wooden playground of my youth, a sanctuary for my sisters and me when we were young. Whatever else we may have been lacking when we were growing up, this was something we did have, a safe and magical place to play outdoors. Wherever we lived, we always had a playground where there were lots of other children. I wanted this for my own children. I wanted it here in New York City, right here in Central Park. I don't know if the general public has any idea about the tremendous pressure that a performer endures just before she's about to drop her normal persona and become vulnerable in front of hundreds of thousands of people. I probably don't appear shy, but in a way I am. It takes enormous effort for me to prepare myself emotionally for a show, to drum up the courage to walk out on the stage and perform. As I've grown, I've learned some techniques that have increased my confidence and enhanced my ability to deal more comfortably with people in general. When negative thoughts arise, I don't hold on to them very long. This is my discipline because I know how destructive it can be to dwell upon them. I have a library of tapes, my tools for inspiration, positive thinking, and spiritual reminders. Sometimes before I go on stage, I play some of my past shows to remind myself of things I have said to keep up the vitality and the energy level. These have served me well when I was so exhausted I thought that it would be impossible to carry on. But it never fails, no matter how bad the pain, how severe the exhaustion, or how sick to my stomach when I walk out on the stage, the pain disappears. It's the audience. Their incredible energy takes it all away. I have had nights when, as I bend over, all I could feel was the unbearable throbbing in my head. When I lifted myself back up, the feeling of alliance with the audience overcame it all, and I went on to perform pain-free. Adrenaline shoots through me during the time that I'm on stage and takes away the pain. Then, the moment I step off the stage and stand in the wings, the pain is back full force. But for the time that it's gone, I feel exalted. It's a phenomenon, a state of grace, a blessing from God. The Bernice Johnson dancers at Central Park were now bending low into the ground, allowing the drum beats to sail up their spines and to shake through their hips and legs. These vibrant dancers were young and fresh. They had never been exposed to such powerful charges of energy before, and they knew exactly what to do with it. As I prepared to join them, the wind blew up unexpectedly with such force, I feared it might blow the children right off the platform stage. It arrived as if out of nowhere. Then I looked to the side scaffolding where my children sat, and I relaxed as I welled up with pride. My kids were busy flipping their heads all around, trying to count the people in the audience, one by one. My kids were the reason I was standing there, the inspiration for this exciting dream. But I could feel that something strange was about to happen. I ran onto the stage. I was there. It was happening. I joined in step with the children. Oh my God. This was the first moment that I could really see and hear the people. The dreamer and the dream had merged. We were now one. In my heart of hearts, I'm a dancer. I love to dance and dance and dance until there's no more me. I hid my face beneath the robe, moving around the stage, my friends shaking, and then It was time. I prepared to shed my multicolored covering. I stood at the back of the stage and allowed the robe sensuously to fall off of me. I stepped out of it, revealing my orange sequined bodysuit with a long chiffon scarf attached to the back. Now I could really feel the audience. I was ready to take them all into my open heart. I ran to center stage. "Hello, New York! You look beautiful!" I called out to them. They responded. I was alert. I was certain that I could hear each of their voices. It was daylight. I could see them all clearly, their faces glowing with ecstatic energy, their hearts wanting to take what I had to give. And I so desperately wanted to give back something to them and to this life that had so blessed me in so many ways. I don't know how long I had been on stage when the darkness appeared. Time is suspended when I'm performing. It wasn't long before that tricky wind blew up again. This time it blew so hard, it blew the sun right out of the sky. Everything darkened. From where had the darkness come? Then the wind came forth in all its glory. It began to whip through the park. Thunder crackled, lightning flashed. My kids, are they all right? I quickly searched them out in the newly arrived darkness. I breathed a sigh of relief. There they were, still looking fine. Of course they're fine. It's just a little weather tantrum. And then, as if diminished by my logical explanation, the agitated wind encircled me with great force, lifting my chiffon scarf up into the air from the floor behind me. I felt as if it were a parachute, that it was about to lift me off the ground. And then the rains came. "It's all right. We're going to get wet. It's okay. I'm here. It feels good, actually." I allowed the water to caress my body like a lover. We were all instantly soaked. People looked baffled. What should we do? The entire park was wall-to-wall people. The rain came down like sheets of shimmering glass, creating a rainbow veil. It felt like a dramatic cleansing ritual. I tried to stay open to it. I'd looked out once again to find my children. But they were gone. Someone must have taken them to the car. I was relieved they had been rescued. My friend Barry Diller magically appeared beside me. He gestured to me that he wanted me to leave the stage, but I would not. Instead, I took his white jacket, covered my saturated thin bodysuit, and went back to my post. At this point, I was cold, shaken, yet unmoving. I knew what I had to do. This was my dream. I was the captain, and I would not abandon ship. If I left now, the last lights would go out, and the darkness would pose an even greater danger than we already had. I took charge. I would be the last to leave after I was certain that everyone else was safe. "If anybody wants to leave, do it slowly," I called. "Please, God, don't let anybody get hurt." I began to silently recite the Lord's Prayer. The musicians, who were standing in inches of water, began quickly to pack up their instruments. They were trying to avoid getting electrocuted, and at the same time trying to save their precious equipment from being ruined by the pelting rain. People were beginning to panic. I heard them screaming that it wasn't safe to stay. I could see that some people were starting to run. "Don't push," I spoke with as much assurance as possible. "Stay calm. It's okay. I'm here." Soon it was only me with the piano player, the drummer, and one faithful cameraman covered in a rain cloth. Through the veils of darkness and the relentless rain, I could see only his arm, and he gave me the thumbs up as if to say, "As long as you stay, so will I." The thunder cracked loudly and more lights went out. I kept singing. It was my way of keeping everybody safe and getting them out of the park. I watched everyone leaving and I felt alone, perhaps more alone than I had ever been. The dream had changed without consulting with me. When someone finally dragged me off the stage, I was still pleading with them not to push. Even then, I tried to keep a happy face, but my tears mixed with the rain and fell to earth, my sorrow and disappointment imprinted in the muddy ground beneath my feet. There was no way out of the park except by foot, so my friend Armando hoisted me up on his back. I was a little girl running piggyback with my friend. As we staggered and slipped our way to the street to attempt yet another impossible task, to find a taxi in New York City in the rain. The miracle was accomplished. I got home. I made a quick phone call and learned that my children were safely at home in Connecticut. They had been taken there by friends, and there they stayed, not returning for my repeat performance the next night. Alone in my New York suite, gazing out the window that overlooked Central Park, I stared at one light. It was all that remained of the entire event. I walked around and around saying my prayers. I hadn't given up. That's not what I do. The children still needed their playground. I still needed to create it, and create it I would. What happened that night was not a part of my plan. But sometimes, no matter how intently we make our own plans, nature has its own design. Learning to let go and let God has been a tremendous lesson for me. We repeated the concert the next day. It had been hard to pull everything back together. I tried to search through my collection of costumes to find something to wear. I ended up with a costume that I had worn before, but it didn't seem to matter. That wasn't what the day was about. It was about overcoming last night and the rain. We were still standing strong. As I ran out on the stage, I could see that it was going to work. The sun was right where it was supposed to be, shining high in the sky. It was beautiful, and all the people were there. It was as if they hadn't left. I looked out at the crowds, and it seemed like there were even more than yesterday. But who was counting? The performance was a big success. We all left there in the sunshine feeling very happy and complete. The entire concert, along with excerpts from the night before, was simulcast all over the world, and millions of people viewed tapes of my rain ritual. I think they understood. I think it was exciting, full of life and nature and all things real. At first, the press wrote sparkling accounts of my experience, revved by sheer excitement. They soon turned on me with a vengeance, as if I had caused the storm. The rain was my fault, it seemed. Only God has the power to add wind and rain to my dreams. So building my dream park didn't happen the way I had planned, but build it I did. A playground on West 86th Street in Central Park. There are a few people who know, but that's not important. What does matter is that as you hear this, children are having fun and running and laughing and safely playing with each other, and their parents can know that while they are there, in that playground of my dreams, they are safe and secure, come rain or shine. Mama, I miss you. Mama, so beautiful. Frightened. Thin. Good. Memorable.
my best friend. Mama. Mama. Mama, I miss you. Needing to talk to you. Can you see me? Look at me, Mama. Look. See how good I am? I'm a woman now. I did really good. Look at my babies. They're okay. Because of you. Are you okay?
I don't remember much of my early childhood. A photo album helps me to feel the time. It's 1947. I was 3 years old. I see myself as a small, waif-like child with vibrant energy. Vital, curious, full of piss and vinegar, and wildly excited to be alive. This picture could be someone else, because I don't have it like that in my mind. But I'm told it's me, all right. She looks shy, coquettish, sweet, mischievous, happy. Her heart is full and open. She wants life and she wants love. She feels everything and she misses nothing. I see me running. I love to run. Feeling like the wind, with wings extended outward, feet planted on the cement below, she flies through space, leaving trails of light behind her. She is fast and elusive, hard to catch or pin down. It is I, Diana of my youth, second in line in a family of six bursting kids.
Mama, I miss you. Mama, what were your dreams? What did you want to be? I see you and me each time I look in the mirror. Were you happy? Were you in pain? I wish you were happy. Did I cause you the both of these? I think I made you happy. I truly hope so.
I was born in Detroit, 5736 St. Antoine, between Palmer and Henry, apartment 23. All of us, the Ross family, were born on this street. Barbara Jean was the first. I thought she was the true beauty of the family. We called her Bobby. I remember loving her, wanting her touch and her warmth, my big sister. She had long, pretty hair, and she was very smart. And she wore glasses. I was the second child, so as I got older, I was always competing with her. I could sing and dance better than she could, I was stronger, and I was very fast. I wanted my parents to like me as much as they liked Bobby. I thought they liked her best, so I would do other things to get their attention. I'd try to entertain the family and see if I could bring a little joy into their lives, especially when I knew they were unhappy. Then Rita was born. She was the baby now, not me. I was the big girl. My brother Fred was the first son, so they gave him my daddy's name, Fred Earl Ross, Jr. Arthur was next. Such a tiny boy, he was called T-Boy. And finally, Wilbert Alex Ross was the last son. He was called Chico. That was us, the Rosses. It's good you're not here now. It's all gone wrong. T has troubles. Chico can't get it together. Rita's sometimes sad. Bobby is full of life and moving on, just like me. Strangely driven by we don't know what. Can you see me, Mama? Can you hear me? Mama. Mama. Mama, can you hear me? Mama, I miss you. We were a handful for Mama, but we knew that she loved us completely. We all knew that. My mother had an incredible dignity about herself. Times were tough, but I never noticed. When I met my father, I was 2 years old. It was the day he returned from the army. When he stood before me, he was a looming figure towering over me, like a giant with his head nearly up against the ceiling. I wanted to be my father's special girl. I was always looking for signs of love and approval in his eyes. He was smart, proud, confident, refined, respectful. He had the benefits of his striking physical presence. Emotionally, miles away. Daddy was a quiet man who didn't talk a lot to anyone. I never succeeded in making that deeper emotional connection with him. Dad was a hard-working man. We didn't have a lot when we were growing up, but everybody that we knew was poor as well, so we didn't feel as if we had any less than anybody else. In fact, we all had about the same. But since Dad worked so hard, it sort of seemed as if we had a little bit more. I now understand my father better. He is a shy man who feels things very deeply. He finds it very hard to express these feelings, and he has never asked for anything. I know he loves his family dearly and has really tried to be there for us through all of our ups and downs. I know that his strength and quiet force has helped shape my life in many ways that I may never be able to express. As untouchable as Dad was, Mama was the opposite. She was all heart. A warm, soft, loving woman. Mama was my hero. I remember her beauty, her zest for life. Her love lies at the foundation of my life. My neighborhood, or shall I say my world, was 2 blocks long. A playground, backyard, porches, fences, alleys. I don't remember trees. I remember telephone poles that I wanted to climb as I got older. I wanted to show how tough I was. I was never afraid. We lived in a big apartment building with lots of units. I used to fly up the stairway, skipping steps, racing against myself, each time seeing how quickly I could get to the floor where we lived. Whenever I walked into the living room, the dark green walls with bright white trim comforted me. I loved sitting on the big, soft, burgundy sofas, the ones that enveloped my small body as I sank down into the center. We were a family that loved music. This narrow living room with windows that looked out onto the alley contained a radio and a record player, one of which was usually turned on. To the left was a fairly open room with French doors, a nice-sized room which was my parents' bedroom. It had their things, their smell, and it always seemed huge to me. Years later, when I heard that the building was about to be demolished, I went back to see it one more time. I felt like a child again when I knocked on the door and asked the people who were living there if I could walk through just once. I felt so sad because Mama and Daddy's smell was gone and everything was so much smaller, as if it had shrunk. At the far end of the hallway was the hub of our life, the bright yellow kitchen that my mother loved so much, that we all loved so much. When I first moved to California, I had my own kitchen painted yellow. I guess I wanted to be like Mama. The back door of the kitchen led onto a small porch that overlooked the backyard, the place where we liked to play. We played so many wonderful games. I remember our vibrant, high-pitched, childish voices calling back and forth in my favorite circle game. Who stole the cookie out of the cookie jar? Not I stole the cookie out of the cookie jar. Then who stole the cookie out of the cookie jar? Number one stole the cookie out of the cookie jar. Not I, and on and on and on. We lived for the summers when we could be outdoors, when the days were long, and even after dinner we could play outside, as long as there was light to see each other. We played Root to Peg, a game where you used a knife to mark the earth. Mama made sure we used only a kitchen knife, nothing too sharp. Anything with a point would do, something that we could stick in the dirt. And there were so many more. We had great games. We laughed hard. We played hard. And we were always outside. I liked riding my bike to Belle Isle, all by myself, just gliding down streets, full of mischief, feeling free. In these moments, the whole world was shining. It's not that Detroit was a beautiful city. It was not. But for me, I felt it was beautiful. All in all, I had a good childhood, and freedom was a large part of it. I loved being alone somewhere, searching the sidewalks for lost change. There's a dime, there's a nickel. It must be my lucky day. I was always lucky, and I knew it. Mama used to do odd jobs to help support the family. On Saturday mornings, she worked at a movie house. I thought it was a very special thing that she did, and I felt so lucky when she would take me with her. Mama and I would get up early in the morning before the rest of the world stirred and walk a long ways to get there. It was the most magical place in the world. When we got there, the theater was empty. I would walk down the aisles and choose any seat I wanted. Mama would bend over and disappear behind the big blaring machine they called a blower. Starting at the back of the theater, she would reach the arm of the angry contraption under each of the seats and blow out all of the trash. She worked fast and hard, making her way up and down every row, never missing a plastic cup or a piece of trash. There was an awful lot of work, and I tried to help, but soon the projectionist would arrive and start playing the day's movie while Mama was still working. Mama just kept blowing that trash, and I got to watch the show. I was instantly mesmerized, even though it was hard to hear the voices over the sound of the blower, and even though the projectionist sometimes just showed parts of the movies. None of that mattered. I felt it was all for me. As soon as the picture was projected on the screen, I was in the movie. Inside the story, up on the big screen, magic. I liked them all. Westerns, love stories. Blacks didn't show up in films at that time, except maybe as slaves or maids. But I was too young to notice such things. I wasn't aware of color. I was simply lost in a magical, emotional world of joy, tragedy, and laughter. I thought it was funny when one of the characters would open up his eyes real wide and say, "Yeah, the boss." I didn't know that when I laughed at him, I was laughing at myself. Growing up in the 50s was a time of great excitement for blacks. It was about Joe Louis winning, and when he did, we all won. We, the Negro people, as we called ourselves then, all desperately needed to win. We were fighting for our self-esteem in order that we might feel good about ourselves, in order that we might feel a sense of freedom. I was a tough kid, a tomboy. "Don't fight," Mama would tell me. "When bad things happen, just walk away." I did as she said. One day when I was 8 years old, I came home from school in tears. My face was red and I was terribly beat up. I finally told Mama that a kid had slapped me in the face, and her past advice, I had walked away. She stroked my burning cheek. "What did they call you?" she wanted to know. "They called me nigger, Mama," I said. Mama's face went cold, and she was really mad. "Don't you ever let anybody hit you in your face and call you a nigger." "Yes, you hear me. I mean for you to fight for all you've got. You know I have never told you to fight before, but I want you to fight for your dear life. Never let anyone make you feel bad about who you are." I was puzzled by her words. Did she really mean what she was saying, or was I misunderstanding her? She went on as if she could read my mind. "Oh, yes, you're hearing me right. And I don't mean just fight either. You'd better win. Because if you don't win, when you come back here, I'm going to whoop your butt." 1 week later, Mama was wiping blood from my nose and washing my bruised face. I had been in a fight, and I couldn't say that I had won. It happened in school. Some kids were picking on me and had called me a name, a bad name, and then they giggled and ran away. I knew they were trying to make me feel bad about myself, but I didn't. I just felt angry. and I hauled off and swung at them. They had hit me back twice and scratched my face before they took off running and laughing. I picked up my school books and I started walking. By the time I had reached home, I had made a decision. From now on, I would fight back, and just as Mama said, I would win. I had to. I would never come home with my face all scratched up again. No more bloody noses. I had decided this, not because of what Mama said. I made the decision for myself this time. I was never going to let anyone put me down again. It was important for me to be strong and to fight back. That was a turning point. There's nothing like waking up Sunday mornings to the sound of someone singing, or humming, or whistling. It's a lovely sound to hear first thing in the day, a new day. My mother always sang around the house. Sometimes she hummed or whistled. My father whistled also. Mama used to sing a very moving spiritual called His Eye is on the Sparrow. I sing because I'm happy. I sing because I'm free. His eye is on the sparrow, and I know he watches me. I was Mama's little sparrow because I was quick and thin and loved to sing. My body felt light as a bird as I would imagine that I could fly away wherever I wanted to go. Freedom was what the sparrow meant to me. Freedom, sensitivity, and delicacy. Mama would sing while she was doing the housework, cooking, cleaning, ironing, and when we walked to church. There was this sweetness in Mama's voice. It was high-toned, but there was a soul in there that felt so vulnerable and strangely sad. It was inside her chest, a sound that gave you goosebumps. My mother had a gospel voice, and she sang, His Eye is on a Sparrow, in a loving tempo, very slow. It was her favorite song. His Eye is on the Sparrow always had great meaning for me. It talks about how God protects all His creatures, even His littlest ones. I think in a sense it was my mother's prayer, or her protection for us. She protected us from so many things in life, trying to shield us from its harsher realities. We never turned our backs on adversity, but used the pain in life to learn from, to grow, and to move on to brighter times. Mama died October 1984. For 2 long years, she suffered terribly. She had been bothered by something in her chest for some time, but she kept it to herself. That was Mama's way. She didn't want to trouble anyone. We took her to the doctor as soon as we knew, but it had gone too far. It was breast cancer. During the last 2 months of my mother's life, I was booked into Radio City Music Hall, one of the most demanding jobs I had ever done. She became weaker with each day, and I began flying back and forth, completely torn between my career commitments and my mother, who I loved more than anyone else. My life had become a nightmare. I wasn't completely present for my work or for my mother. I finally got my dear, loving housekeeper, Geneva, to go there to be with her. She really took care of my mother those last days, those last hours. Mama had tried to protect me from pain all my life, and now that she was suffering, I felt so helpless. It was a race against time. I would close the show in New York, jump on a plane, fly to Detroit, stay with Mama all day, jump back on a plane, and open the show the next night. I can't remember when I slept or ate. At Radio City, I was in such grief and so distracted. The audience can never know what is happening in a performer's life, and I was not open to talking about my pain. In hindsight, I wish I had canceled those shows and been completely there for my mother, even though there were lots of other caregivers. I would have been happier today if I had been there all the time. When things are actually happening, it isn't easy to know what's right. I can count on my fingers the number of times I have canceled engagements or shows. Even though I am facing a great personal tragedy, I refuse to back out of an engagement. It has always been very important for me to keep my word. Integrity and honesty form the bookends of my life. I was about 5 steps away from my mother when she passed. Where does life go? So vibrant and full in one moment, and in the next moment, gone forever. I wish she and I had talked more about her hopes and dreams and about who she really was. I hadn't had a chance to give her all the things and the kind of life she deserved. She had worked so hard for us, given up her dreams for her 6 children. The space my mother occupied in my heart and in my life is empty now. I feel the loss, the ache. We are never prepared. Through that loss, I am reminded of the importance of health, secure financial future, spending time with family and those you love. I've always looked at the more positive side of things. All the pain I've had in my life, I'll hold on to it for a second, and then I let it go. I really try to let go of all the negativity and leave the rest up to God. That's one of the beautiful gifts my mother gave me. The ability to allow certain things to be. My childhood gave me the greatest gift available, my profound spiritual faith, a faith that has been simple and unwavering throughout my life. My story has often been referred to as a classic rags to riches, but in truth, that description doesn't fit me at all. For starters, the Rosses were never raggedy. We may not have had a lot of money and every moment wasn't great, but I was brought up to have ideals, to believe that anything was possible and that hard work was part of that. With these ideals, so many things just clicked in a beautiful harmony. I don't think I ever thought, you can't get anywhere from here. Those words never really formed in my mind because there was no place that I knew I wanted to go. Until I was about 10 years old, I didn't know there was a world out there to explore. I simply took life as it came and took advantage of each opportunity that presented itself. And I never accepted the idea that I couldn't achieve something that I wanted. I was taught that I could. My life could have taken many different turns. I could have easily become tough. Some of the neighborhood bullies were my friends. I used to watch the prostitutes who walked the streets nearby. Although I admired their flashy clothes, I could feel the sadness in their hearts. I knew that I had something different ahead of me. I had no idea what it was. I just lived my life and kept moving. I can't remember when I actually began singing. I think I always sang. I must have come out of the womb that way. I used to trail after my mother when she did her household chores. The walls of our apartment swelling with music, jazz, blues, Etta James. To me, Etta was the one, my original inspiration. The shock of hearing a voice so powerful and so deep made me marvel that one young woman could claim such power and passion. When I was still a very small child, I remember sneaking off by myself and entering into my own little world of entertainment. I would stand up in front of the mirror in a trance, watching my lips move and my body sway as I sang along with an Etta James record, like Dance With Me, Henry, performing for a wildly cheering imaginary audience. After our first home on St. Antoine, we moved to 635 Belmont. It was there that I met my handsome neighbor, William Robinson, better known to the world as Smokey. While still in my early teens, I had a girlfriend named Sharon Burston, who was Smokey Robinson's niece. They lived right down the street from me. When I slept over at her house, she and I would spend hours sitting on the basement steps watching her uncle rehearse with his group called The Miracles. One day, when I was at a friend's house, we turned on the radio and I heard a familiar song. One of Smokey's records, Got a Job, had actually gotten radio play. It was his first release and his first hit, I was thrilled. I rushed home, crashed through the front door, and yelled, "Mama, Smokey's made a record, and they're playing it on the radio. He did it." I knew that if he could do it, I wanted to do it too. It made me feel like nothing was impossible. At that time, I had no far-reaching dreams to become a celebrity or a movie star. I just wanted to make a record. I wanted to sing. It became a reality to me that afternoon when I heard that Smokey and the Miracles record on the radio, that someone could actually record a song and have a hit, and that thousands of people would hear it. I was 14 when we moved from 635 Belmont to the Brewster Housing Projects in Detroit. It was there that I met Mary Wilson and Florence Ballard. The three of us hit it off. When we first started singing together, we did it on a casual basis. As people, we couldn't have been more different, but our voices made an interesting blend, and so did our personalities. Florence was tall, proud, and beautiful, with fair skin and fine hair. She was absolutely regal, and the strength in her voice matched her carriage. She was capable of such high volume. With the proper training, maybe she could have sung opera. The truth is that some of the early songs, like Baby Love and Where Did Our Love Go, were too petite for her and just didn't match the depth of her voice. The record business was looking for something that sounded like the Chantels or the Shirelles. Mary Wilson proved to be the buffer. Despite the fact that Mary mostly sang the lower tones, she had a beautiful harmony voice with a great deal of warmth to it. She fit so well with Florence and me. She carried the exact sound just between the two of us that blended all our voices together, the sound that made up the perfect harmony note so that we were like one voice. And Mary had charisma on stage. She was the sexy one. She loved to wiggle her hips and bat her eyes at the men in the front row and give off that come-and-get-me attitude. Florence was much more standoffish. Her regalness would never allow her to demonstrate that kind of raw energy. I was more aligned with Florence in that way. Although we had a childlike sex appeal, I never chose to express it blatantly. I was always interested in elegance and the music, and I was singing for the pure enjoyment of it. My gift was being able simply and honestly to express the emotions of a song. For that reason, my voice worked best as lead singer on the kind of material we used, and I was able to balance out the other two, becoming a blend of Mary's sexual energy and Florence's regal attitude. The three of us together made an unbeatable combination. I must have been no more than 14 or 15 when we first started singing together, because I remember that I was still walking to school every day. It was the spring of 59, and I was finishing the ninth grade. At that time, Betty McGlown was also part of the group. She was a beautiful girl, tall, very thin, and dark-skinned, a good singer. When she left us to get married, she and I lost touch. We loved to sing more than anything, and we used to get together and rehearse as often as we could, with no idea of how to get to the next step. When you want something bad enough, somehow it happens. Florence, who was from a very big family, had a beautiful older sister. I think she was dating a manager named Milton Jenkins. He dressed really slick, and he cruised around in a big red Cadillac convertible. It was Milton Jenkins who really got us started, when he brought around this group of guys from Alabama to meet us girls. Milton Jenkins thought that our group and Cal, Eddie, and Paul, who called themselves the Primes and were trying to make an act for themselves, might be a good match to sing together. Although we never performed with them until much later on, when we were the Supremes and they were the Temptations, we used to rehearse with them after school. Using the name of the Primettes, we became a sister group to these guys, and Milton Jenkins started managing us, too. After Betty left, We were only three, but we still felt that we needed a fourth, so we took on Barbara Martin. The four of us sang and rehearsed together for the next few years. So you see, changes within the group had already begun happening before we ever walked in the door of Motown for that first audition. Singing became my life. I lived, ate, drank, and breathed it. It was all that I cared about. My only obstacle was Dad. He was a practical man, a solemn man, and he was very much opposed to my taking singing seriously. He wanted me to go to college and to get a good education so that I would be well equipped to take care of myself in a highly competitive world. It was very difficult to get his permission to be a primate. I finally managed, but in those days it was a struggle with him each step of the way. The primates continued to rehearse, and soon when we felt ready, we began to perform at neighborhood parties. We loved performing, and the harder we worked, the hotter our act became. Sometimes, when we were hired to perform at a large event, they announced us on the radio. The mere mention of our names brought us a great deal of pride and excitement. We may have been young, but we were seriously working towards our goal. We were determined to cut a record. Music, even at this stage in my development, was already giving my life the magic and meaning that I so desperately wanted. I knew that with my music I had something of my own, and it would last a lifetime if I so desired. Singing was always a gift, whether it was rehearsing, performing, or just playing around with other kids in the neighborhood. It brought me pleasure and self-confidence, especially when I saw that I could make people smile and move their bodies. Being an inspiration to the people around me was one of my greatest joys, and it still is. We had been singing together for a couple of years when I finally decided to ask Smokey Robinson if he could get us an audition with Berry Gordy at Motown. Berry Gordy was managing Smokey and the Miracles. They had a big hit song, and they were already a big deal. Smokey and I were good friends. We had gotten to know each other when I lived on Belmont, so I felt I could call him to hear us sing. My plan was that he would like us and get us the audition that we wanted. One day the girls and I were all together driving in a car when we spotted a tall, skinny-looking guy walking down the street with a big guitar on his back. "Stop the car," I said. We all watched him for a few minutes, and we all sensed a kind of sweetness coming from him. That was what made me feel safe enough to talk to him. "That's our guitar player. I just know that's him," I told the girls. Now I needed to drum up the courage to talk to him. "But what are you going to say to him? He doesn't know us. Why would he want to play with us?" somebody asked. "We'll just ask him," I said. So I opened up the window and yelled out, "Hey you, we're singers. You want to play guitar for us?" He must have thought we were crazy, but he smiled and we got his telephone number. His name was Marvin Tarplin. And it turned out that he was a great guitar player and a wonderful person. That's how it happened. It seemed that in those days, there was a strange kind of magic flowing through the air, arranging things and creating a synergy, making everything happen as if it had been pre-planned. Maybe it was a lack of resistance, an innocence of youth that just trusts the process as it unfolds. I don't know what Marvin was doing before our encounter on the street, but we started rehearsing with him right away, and it worked out beautifully. When we felt we were ready, I called Smokey. "Smokey, I have a group. Would you please listen to us?" I asked him. To my delight, he agreed. It wasn't really an audition. Smokey was still young, and he wasn't an executive at Motown yet. We knew that if he liked us, he had the power to set something up for us. We went to one of their rehearsals and sang our hearts out for them. I'll always remember that evening. It was the night he stole Marvin, my guitar player. He took him on the road, but he also set up the audition for us. A loss and a gain. I think Marvin still plays guitar for Smokey. Rats, roaches, guts, and love. That's how Berry Gordy described Motown in the early days. These words may have confused some people who took them literally. He was talking about the nitty-gritty of life then, of the elements that went into making a record company happen in a big way. Creating Motown and making it a success was a massive undertaking, a bold dream, a courageous vision, and Berry Gordy had what it took to do it. Smokey went with us to Motown for the audition, to the building we call Hitsville, USA. The Hitsville studio is still there to this day. I can remember the way it was in vivid detail. It was so simple, just a strange little square room. A drum set stood in the far left-hand corner, beside the staircase that led downward into another room below. Microphones were set up all over the room, which they used to move around to create different sounds. We stood up there in a straight line in front of some of Motown representatives to do our audition, our nerves on edge, emotions highly amplified. They were all strangers to us. Smokey wasn't there in the room, he was waiting outside. We sang a few songs a cappella that we had painstakingly prepared for this day. The tension was high. We knew that this was a pivotal moment for us. We did our very best songs. In the middle of the last one, There Goes My Baby, a song in which I sang lead, Berry Gordy himself came walking into the room. We had never met him before. We had only heard about him, but we instantly knew who he was. The man had a presence. You could feel the energy shift and crackle as the others reacted to their boss entering the room. He was obviously on his way to somewhere else, but he paused momentarily to listen to us. He stood there until we finished the song and he said, "Sing that song over again." So we did. "Very nice, girls, very nice." That was all he said, and then he swiftly left the room. I think we did a great job in our first audition. I was anxious to hear what Berry Gordy would have to say to us. Of course, we wanted to get signed right then and there. We waited a little while for him to talk to us. It felt like forever. I remember the extreme anxiety of sitting in that room, so afraid, because I knew that Berry Gordy was the man who could make or break us. When he finally came back, he was somewhat encouraging. He liked us. He liked our sound, but he insisted that we were too young for a contract. "Go and finish school, work on your music, and then come back and audition again," he said. We left very discouraged, but in no way broken down. In fact, I think we were more determined than ever. Berry Gordy was not the only one who knew what he wanted. I have never been able to take no for an answer, and he had definitely not seen the last of me. During the entire year of 1960, on just about any given afternoon, if somebody asked my mother where I was, the answer would almost always be the same. "She's at Motown." Mary Florence and I were the sole members of the group by then. We could hardly wait for school to get out so that we could ride the bus to Motown every day. Everybody at Motown got used to seeing us. We quickly became permanent fixtures there. At first, we just hung around trying every kind of persuasion we could to get them to give us a contract. We met all the recording artists, and very soon, although we hadn't yet gotten the contract we wanted, we did manage to sing backup for some of the established groups. They weren't paying much, but money meant very little to us then. It was all very valuable experience, and in those days we were thrilled to be doing anything at all. In the summer of 1960, the Primettes traveled across the river from Detroit to Windsor, Canada. We had decided to compete in an amateur talent contest, and we were very excited. We were merely teenagers, and this contest, which drew on talent from both Detroit and Canada, had attracted an audience of thousands. After performing mostly at record hops and community events, this felt like the big time. As we walked out on the stage, my heart sped up, and a shot of adrenaline rushed up my spine. This was what I loved and what I wanted to do. All eyes were on us as we sang our standard songs. We were revved up. We had rehearsed hard for this, and the audience cheered and screamed when we were finished. We won the contest, but more important, I had the first taste of the delicious feeling that comes from creating a rapport with so many people at the same time, and the sense of being appreciated and rewarded for a job well done. We all left elated, and we wanted more. In order to maintain the support of my parents, I had to be very careful at home, making sure that I got my schoolwork done. Florence had a similar arrangement with her parents, but she wasn't as conscientious as I was. Her parents, like mine, never really wanted her to sing full-time, and they were extremely concerned because she wasn't doing well at school right from the beginning. Florence was not easy. She had a strong personality, just like her voice. Everything about her was big. When she was happy, it was contagious. Everybody was happy. When she was unhappy, everybody around her felt miserable. She was terribly moody, constantly up and down, and she was hard to figure out. We could never really understand what drove her moods. Maybe she didn't know herself. Finally, at the beginning of 1961, our perseverance won out and our dreams came true. Berry Gordy decided to give us a recording contract. We were still a year away from graduating from high school. We were beside ourselves with excitement. It was the most wonderful thing that had ever happened to us. Berry informed us that he didn't like the name The Primettes. We needed to find a new one. We thought about it for a long time, but we were not inspired. One day, when only Florence was at the studio, Janie Bradford, a great songwriter, who was working at Motown's Switchboard, handed her a list of what she considered good ideas. She told Florence that the contracts were being drawn up and she had to pick our name immediately. Florence picked the Supremes, because it was the only one that didn't have an et on the end. I hated the name then. By the time we arrived at the studio, it was settled and already on the contracts. I was only 16 when we were called in for the signing of the contracts. We were all teenagers, and therefore our parents were required to be present. In fact, they were really the ones who signed, as we were still under the legal age limit. It had always been a battle with Dad, and this time was no exception. He was still dead set against my singing for a living, but after much pressure and pleading, he gave in, against his better judgment, of course. Although we girls were jumping out of our skins with enthusiasm, I recall the skepticism in all of our parents when we came together at Motown on that auspicious afternoon. They just didn't trust this little guy, Berry Gordy, not with our emotional development or with our money. Our enthusiasm was impossible to quell. We got what we wanted. We became Motown artists on January 15, 1961. Actually, we did our first recording on a label called Tamla, under the organization of Berry Gordy Enterprises. He soon switched us to the Motown label. In March 1961, we released a single called I Want a Guy. It was our first recording for Berry Gordy, and I vividly remember this recording session. With my eyes closed and my arms outstretched, I poured my heart into this song. When I listen back to it, I can hear that teenage yearning in my voice. We never had actual voice lessons, but we got some help from a big, heavy-set sweetheart of a guy named Maurice King. He was a dear man, and he used to tell us things like how to hit the right notes, how to avoid being flat or sharp, and how to make more interesting harmonies. I wish we had had the opportunity to have formal voice training. But when we began singing professionally, singing lessons just weren't part of the program. As time went on, what motivated me to improve the quality of my voice was pure survival. I had to keep myself from getting hoarse or from losing my voice altogether. And so I was forced to start singing correctly, to sing from deep down in my diaphragm. I also began breathing correctly, not from a shallow place, but also from deep within. I would take these full breaths and try to let the singing just come out of me. That's when my voice transformed. I have a special place in my heart for the old Hitsfield building that Motown used for recording. We were convinced, like a lot of other groups, that our unique sound came from the way our voices bounced off the walls and the windows. We recorded in every, and I mean every nook and crevice of that building. The hallways, the stairwells, next to the walls, and even the bathroom. The hallways with the windows open created a different sound than the hallways with the windows closed. When we sang next to one of the holes in the walls, that changed the sound too. We were so inventive then. We had no synthesizers or electronics of any sort. We would create sounds from whatever was around, like placing a bell on a chair and ringing it in different ways. Have you ever sung in the shower and thought how good and interesting it sounded? There was a bathroom in the Hitsfield building which happened to be located behind the control room and ended up being a perfect echo chamber. When I was doing leads, they would sometimes put my microphone in the bathroom to give my voice an echo effect. I remember late one evening when my throat hurt and I was weary and wanted to go home, finding myself singing my heart out beside the toilet bowl in this famous bathroom and thinking, I guess show business isn't as glamorous as I thought it was. Our first release under the Motown label was Your Heart Belongs to Me, recorded in May of 1962. We did quite a few more, but nothing was a hit. We were frustrated, but we never gave up. In fact, up until when the love light started shining through his eyes in October of 1963, we didn't have a hit. That was the beginning. When the love light started shining through his eyes, which quickly went to the top 20, had that real, definable Motown sound. We had just begun working with some songwriters called Holland, Dozier, Holland. Brian Holland had a strong gospel sense, and he was the one who worked out the part for the lead singer. Lamont Dozier was in charge of the harmonies and the background sounds, the music that goes beneath the lead to support her. And Eddie Holland created the performance level. Together they made an incredible triangle, just as the three of us did. Holland Dozier Holland became our main songwriters, and it was yet another great blend, another example of synergy that was a piece of the magic that was Motown at that time. The relationship between the singers and the songwriters at Motown was unique. We all worked together as a single unit, so each song was created with a specific singer in mind. The girls and I were fresh out of school. We were ready to explore the world with bright, eager eyes and wide, open hearts. We were naive, and we gave off an innocence, a freshness. And so the songs that Holland Dozier Holland created for us reflected that innocence and that naivete. It's not that we were immune to the fact that the 60s was a time of great turbulence, with the sexual revolution, the civil rights movement, and Vietnam. It's not that we were disinterested in the protest and the rebellions that were exploding in the world around us. It was quite the opposite. We were very interested, and we cared. And in our own childlike way, we were contributing to the times. You see, all the war and protests were the trademarks of the 60s. Peace and love were the underlying fabric. The romantic quality of the innocent love songs that the Supremes became associated with were not only extremely well suited to our style, but were easy for people to understand and relate to. Our lives were moving and changing at an incredible pace. It was difficult to focus on anything beyond ourselves, the present moment, and the immediate next step. We didn't know exactly what the next step was, but we knew we were headed somewhere big. I had a lot to guide me and sustain me then. My direction, my determination, a commitment to hard work instilled by my family, and the support and encouragement of Berry Gordy. At times, my surrogate father, at other times, my controller and slave driver. How do I begin to define my relationship with Berry? A connection that began when I was 15. And although it has completely altered, still exists today, some 35 years later. As all relationships do, ours went through many changes and took on various forms over the years. Sometimes Berry was a father to me. At other times, a partner and a cohort. And finally, at others, controlling and dominating. He and I could sail along on the identical wavelength, Riding the surf so perfectly, we left everybody on the shore, or we could clash so dramatically. Barry was one of the most important men in my life when I was young. Even when I was deeply wounded by the startling lack of sensitivity he was capable of demonstrating, even when I felt unseen and emotionally abused, I always recognized him as a visionary, a dynamite character, a special human being. Even in our first audition, Barry Gordy must have recognized something special in us. I'm certain that if he hadn't, he would never have allowed us to hang around Hitsville every day. Although we were frustrated a great deal and wondered if we would ever get what we truly wanted, this waiting game was an important period in our development. In hindsight, I can see that it was during this time, before we were signed, that we were getting our act together. Although the refining process took on greater proportions after our first big hit and continued on all throughout our career, we had already begun creating that special look that was uniquely ours. Even as teenagers, we had a sense of sophistication that made us stand out from the other performers. Nobody created that look for us. We did it ourselves. We brought it to Motown. None of the girls in the other groups wore gowns like ours, at least not until we introduced that fashion evening look. We took great pleasure in wearing beautiful gowns and jewelry. We always looked like young ladies. More influence from my mother. Once again, the things that I've learned from Mom became an integral part of who the Supremes came to be. How fitting that when we embarked on our first tours, she should travel with us as chaperone. Although Barry Gordy contributed to our choices of songs and our direction, I can't really give him or Motown any credit for the sophisticated elegance that the Supremes had, or for the self-esteem, morals, and standards that we had. That's who we already were. Barry Gordy did not have to create young ladies from ghetto teens like some inner-city Liza Doolittles. We were already ladies who had been brought up right. These fine qualities were already ours, instilled in us by our upbringing and our families. It was what he already saw in us that Barry Gordy helped us develop. These natural qualities that he began to nurture and pull together. We worked hard over the next year, doing lots of recording, including our first album, Meet the Supremes. On the original release of this album, we wore exquisite dresses I had made. I took great pride in them and considered these handmade outfits to be the very height of fashion. Few people ever saw that version of the album cover, because after we hit the charts big in the next year, they decided to re-release the album with a new cover photo that was a shot closer in so you could really see our faces. In April 1964, we recorded Where Did Our Love Go? It wasn't scheduled to be released until sometime in the summer. In the meantime, they had booked us on a tour called Dick Clark's Caravan of Stars. But we were not mentioned separately in any of the press releases. The ads read Gene Pitney, the Shirelles, Brenda Holloway, and others, and that was us and others. Before we left, Barry Gordy's sister, Esther Edwards, who worked at Motown, called us into her office. She wanted us to know how lucky we were, that they had to beg just to get us on the tour, that we were really there only as filler. I didn't care. Besides our trip to Canada to compete in the talent contest, we hadn't been anywhere, and we barely knew there was a world outside of the one in which we had been raised. As a kid growing up in a small neighborhood, all you know and all you hear are the family sounds that expand beyond the paper-thin walls of the apartment next door. We knew there were other worlds to explore. Beautiful homes in certain parts of Detroit where no blacks lived because we couldn't afford them. I wanted more. I wanted to see the face of America. It was on that tour that my mother, who went along as chaperone for us, was affectionately dubbed Mama Supreme. It was sometimes difficult traveling with my mother, for the tour was hard and Mama was special, so I mostly loved it. It certainly made things better with Dad. In some of those southern towns, you could just feel the bigotry in the air. You could slice it with a knife like stinking cheese. Sometimes we were afraid to get off the bus and ask where the toilet was. There were many times that we would stop at a cafe or gas station and we were not allowed to use the public restrooms. We had to squat beside the bus and pee in the bushes. I think the most frightening experience of all happened in Macon, Georgia. Late one night after a performance, a sniper shot at us as we were leaving the concert hall. At that time, it was strict segregation in Georgia. We used to try to integrate the audiences. When we heard the shots, we took off towards the bus as quickly as we could. We tore up the stairs of that bus so fast, people fell into the aisles and rolled on top of each other. When we got far enough away for our hearts to stop pounding, we saw that the gunshots had gone right through the metal, hit the glass window, and the entire front of the bus was full of tiny gunshot holes. When the tour began, we were the opening act. As the summer wore on, Where Did I Love Go, which had been released in June while we were already traveling, started gaining popularity. At first, we were so busy riding the bus and performing, we were unaware of what was happening with our record. But the audiences knew. They began to recognize us. They would scream and shout when we appeared on stage. And when we got to the wings, we'd scream at each other. They know our songs! They're out there dancing to our song. I'll never forget the thrill of riding on the bus, being halfway across the country from Detroit, and hearing our song being played on the radio. Sometimes, when we made our pit stops in some small towns, we'd run to the newsstands to find a copy of Billboard or Cashbox magazine to see where we stood in the charts. All of the things that I had dreamed of when I had first heard Smokey's song on the radio were happening to us. The dream was coming true. By the end of the summer, we had the number one song in the country, and we were headlining the show. Imagine it. In one summer, we had gone from being the openers, the bottom of the barrel, to being the most popular group. It seemed impossible to believe that our group was now being billed above Gene Pitney. When we finished the Dick Clark tour and returned to Detroit, everything had changed. We recorded Baby Love and Come See About Me that year. So along with Where Did I Love Go, we had three consecutive number one hits. The Supremes had made it. Everybody knew about us and knew that we could sing. As performers, we still needed polishing, and I, for one, was ready and eager. Barry put us into a program that he had created for Motown called Artist Development. It was like attending a finishing school. Maxine Powell, who had originally been a model and then went on to become a modeling teacher, was one of the most important influences at that time. There were so many little things that she gave us. When we started wearing miniskirts, it added a whole new set of problems, like sliding out of a car like a lady. Then there were the times when we were singing with a band and someone would say, "Get up and sit on the piano." There was a graceful way to do that, too. To glide up there. It was Maxine Powell who showed me how to do it without looking phony. We giggled a lot about this, but when we had finished her training, we could sit at the table with Princess Margaret and feel at ease. Another aspect of our artistic development was working with Charlie Atkins, a wonderful and talented choreographer. He worked mostly with Mary and Florence, as they needed to smooth out the background steps. Since I sang the leads, I was in the position to play the audience. I was given the space to walk from here to there as my mood and the energy of the song moved me. In a certain sense, I was winging it, for there was no one around to show me how to act as a lead singer, and there was no way to watch myself. There weren't any monitors, and there was no video then, so you couldn't practice your act, watch your performance, see what needed changing, and then go back and do it again. There were no mirrors or reflections to study. In those days, most of it, like the Ed Sullivan Show, was live. Our career was hands-on. Barry Gordy would sit in the audience with a large legal pad, taking detailed notes, and then come backstage after every performance and tell us what we did wrong. He always had notes, tighten up the act, You sang this wrong. You girls weren't moving together. You weren't smiling. On and on and on. The information was helpful. It was always geared towards improving our act. But Barry behaved like a tyrant, and his way of talking about our performance and pointing these things out was heavily judgmental, discouraging, and ultimately very hard on us. We weren't Barry's sole focus. He was the leader, and everyone wanted his focus and approval. But he played favorites and set up an unhealthy internal climate. He used to say things to other performers like, "Why can't you be more like Diana? She makes her plans, she works really hard, she rehearses all day long, and she records all night." Comparing is a terrible thing to do in a family situation. If you have three kids and single out one of them and keep saying to the others, "Why can't you be like her?" it produces crippling sibling rivalry. I feel that's how it all started, and it became a very difficult situation for me. I became the good child, the object of Dad's affection, and everyone turned against me. I lived under constant stress. I was the object of everybody's jealousy then. I bore the brunt of a lot of blame. I am quite clear that I am not responsible for anybody else's successes or failures. All I know is, I worked hard all this time. After our initial success, it was as if we were charmed and we kept on recording hits. Motown had a great drummer, Benny Benjamin, who played for us. In fact, he played on almost every record that came out of Motown and was partially responsible for that driving Motown sound. Holland Dozier Holland were still composing for us, and we became the only singing group to have 6 consecutive gold records in 1 year. I will never forget the first time we worked at the Copacabana. I did our makeup and hair, and this was the first time that we ever signed autographs. I stood there in amazement, holding a piece of paper that someone had asked me to sign, knowing for certain that life had changed. As the Supremes became more and more popular, we knew that along with how hard we were working and the magic we were creating, we were also lucky. We had a strong life force, and things just happened for us. Dick Clark took a special liking to us, and he wanted us on his shows, which contributed a great deal to maintaining our popularity. The highs were high, but the tension that accompanied them, the work that was required to maintain our performance quality during the recording and the extensive touring, was overwhelming and debilitating. Sometimes the stress got so bad I couldn't eat. It got so that I couldn't even tolerate the smell of food. Perhaps it was an early form of anorexia. I was becoming skin and bones, and eating became repulsive. It was a very unhappy time for me. Most of the kids that I knew who were my age were out having a good time, dancing, dating, spending time with their boyfriends. But I was just working. I felt out of touch, out of control. Although the Supremes were at the top, I often felt as if I was sitting at the bottom of a deep, dark pit. Barry was very worried about me. Even though he had a rough style, he also had a caring, sensitive side to him. He did everything he could to take care of me. I remember performing in Chicago during the time of year when the chill factor is well below zero. When I got off stage each night, I was in a cold sweat and having chills. So Barry rubbed down my arms, legs, and feet with alcohol and covered me up so I wouldn't catch a cold. At those times, I really felt that he loved me. Once I was so stressed out, I got an angry skin rash. I broke out with blotches all over my body. It was just nerves. Our schedules were grueling, and I never had enough sleep. My shoulders were always high. I used to carry them right up to my neck. It got so bad, Barry was often at a loss to know what to do with me. Once he flew my brother Chico in to see me because he thought it would make me happy. He was always trying to make me eat, which made me even more nervous. He wanted to make me strong so that I could keep going on stage and singing, but I kept getting skinnier and skinnier. As I think back on this time, it brings tears to my eyes. It was so incredibly stressful, and I'm trying to figure out why. I guess it was the demands of performing and the fear of not being good enough. It was the pressure of trying to do everything right for everybody else and losing myself in both the Supremes and in the process. In those days when we were doing the Motortown Review, for example, we would do 5 or 6 shows a day. They were short shows in which we performed only 1 or 2 songs, but they went on all day long, so there was never any time to rest or simply enjoy our success. We played what we call the Chitlin Circuit, theaters like the Apollo in New York, the Regal in Washington, D.C., and the Royal in Baltimore. We worked with Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, the Shirelles, Otis Redding, O.C. Smith, all the stars who were around at that time. My mother wasn't with us then, but we always had a chaperone, a lady who made sure that after we finished the shows, we got into our car and arrived safely back at the hotel. I think the Apollo was my favorite, because they used to have these steakhouses down the street where you could go out between performances and have delicious steak sandwiches and baked potatoes. For some reason, they were really appealing to me, and it was one of those few meals I enjoyed eating. Even with that, even as much as I enjoyed performing, the stress was not relieved, because there was the perpetual pressure of doing it right for Barry. He used to love to put us on the spot and embarrass us, even after we had gained great commercial success. Perhaps it was premeditated, his way of maintaining control over us. We would just happen to walk into a room where he was talking with some industry people, and he would snap his fingers and say, "Okay, girls, stand over there and do this song. Any song. Just do it. Just do it a cappella. Come on. Come on, just do it." Once when we were in Japan, he and I had a meeting with some powerful promoters. Barry suddenly turned to me and said, "Just sing the song." Intimidated and dreadfully uncomfortable, I heard this tiny little speaking voice come out of me and say, "Well, I never really sung this song without music, but I'll try." And I did. Sang the song on the spot without music. Then there was the Ed Sullivan Show. They wanted us to do our biggest hit at the time, but Barry had a different idea. He wanted people to know that we could sing show tunes, so Barry started doing what Barry does best, making a deal. Bob Preck was the Ed Sullivan producer, and Barry said to him, "Okay, we'll let you have this number one record, but at the same time, you have to let them do one of their standard songs." And we had to get up again and spontaneously sing something a cappella for Bob Preck. Barry nearly always got what he wanted, and it was always for our best, but at our expense. It was a hard time then, a public time. We were whisked in and out of cars and tour buses, and we were constantly being probed and interviewed about all facets of our lives. And yet my time with the Supremes, as stressful and difficult as it was, lives in my mind as a positive experience. One of the things that I'm most proud of is the fact that the Supremes were trailblazers, both as women and as black artists. When I first began my career, while we were traveling through the South, I didn't know who was buying the music. Even then, although unaware, we were already crossing color lines and breaking racial barriers. When you think of it, music is a perfect way to accomplish this, because people don't see the color of your skin when they're listening to the radio. So our tours through the South, as dangerous and scary as they were, ended up serving a higher purpose. Since both blacks and whites were loving, enjoying, and listening to the music, we were actively changing the world by doing what we loved, singing. Mary, Florence, and I were not true sisters. Other groups like the Ronettes and the Jackson Five were actually blood relatives, and they had been brought up together in the same house. The girls and I started out as 3 strangers who were randomly placed together. When difficulties arose, we did not have the kind of bond that automatically exists among family members. We didn't have the kind of commitment or understanding that no matter what happens, we were together forever. We discussed this. We try to treat it like a club. You be the president, you be the vice president, I'll be the secretary, and when things come up, we'll just work it out within that context. This was effective at first, but when the energy escalated, it just didn't work anymore. Changes are organic to life experience. So when I look back, it is no surprise that changes occurred within the Supremes. All things considered, it was actually quite natural. But when change happens, it is a human characteristic to resist that change or to wonder what went wrong. Really, nothing went wrong. The shifting was all in the natural scheme of things. Under normal circumstances, change is viewed as inevitable and for the good of progress. The circumstances of our lives were far from normal. When the momentum of our success got moving, it blew in like a wild hurricane. In our attempt to keep grounded, we lost perspective. By the mid-60s, life was becoming very difficult. We were basically living out of suitcases, touring endlessly, doing one-nighters all across the country and recording albums, laced with touring through Europe. It was very tough to maintain the stamina to keep going. You had to love singing so much, you had to want it so bad in order to work at it that hard. Florence loved to sing, but she just didn't seem to be able to keep up with the lifestyle. She was always tired and angry, and eventually the pressure became too much for her. I can't remember exactly when she started drinking, but it was sometime during the period of constant touring. At first it was beer, but after a while that wasn't enough to drown out her pain. She went on to hard liquor. Often when we went on stage, she would be completely out of it, and it seemed as if she didn't care. I'll never forget a show we did at the Flamingo Hotel in Las Vegas. Mary and I were thrilled to be there. It was one of those places that we never imagined at the beginning of our careers we'd get a chance to play. But here we were, as excited as we could be, and then Florence showed up late and drunk. Our costumes were tuxedos. Florence had gained so much weight, her stomach was bulging out of her costume. We were embarrassed to go on stage with her. There were times when she'd miss recording sessions and even shows. She just wouldn't show up, and we didn't know where she was or what she was doing. I remember once, suddenly, we realized at showtime that Florence hadn't arrived. Mary and I were frantic. We ended up having to go on without her. We abandoned the regular choreography, and after grabbing the hand mics, we walked around the stage and sang just the two of us. During that time, I recorded "Someday We'll Be Together," a wonderful song by Johnny Bristol. The reason I say I recorded is that although no one knew it at the time, the girls were not my backup singers. I guess this will destroy a lot of illusions, but Mary and Florence were not even at the session. We couldn't get them there. A couple of other girls did it. Things were not the same. I was beginning to be singled out. Changes were in the air. Florence was not well. She had serious emotional problems, but we didn't know that then. We just saw her as angry. She drank too much and wouldn't take responsibility for herself. She blamed everyone else for the things that were not working out in her life. When we were getting lots of press that started to mention only my name, it was difficult for her. She started acting out in a big way, and very soon became aware of how bad things were. One night in Las Vegas, while I was talking to Barry on the phone, he heard a commotion. Florence was drunk, and she was yelling and carrying on. "What's going on there?" Barry wanted to know. I didn't want to tell him how bad it was, but before I could try to protect her, she grabbed the phone out of my hand and said, "Who is it? Who is it on this phone?" Barry heard her voice and knew immediately what was going on. He jumped on the next plane to Vegas. He wanted to know the full extent of what was happening and to see if he could do something about it. Nothing could be done. I think it was even out of Florence's control. In retrospect, her depression was more than just a mood. It was obviously something medical. It was no longer possible for the group to go on as before. At the beginning of 1967, by mutual consent, Florence left the group. Before Florence died, I honestly did not know that she was as sick as she was, or that she was anywhere close to death. Florence's life was always a mystery to me. I don't think that she ever wanted to be a singer as much as her family wanted it for her, and ultimately for themselves. On the day of the funeral, I had no idea the extent of the angers and resentments I was facing. I showed up to show my love and friendship and concern for her three children. I wanted to be supportive and helpful. It was like walking straight into the fire. The funeral was a mess. It was utter chaos. The press and the public pushed their way in. It became a sideshow with gawking people everywhere. I felt embarrassed and deeply sad that there was no respect shown for Florence. I went straight for the kids. My greatest concern was to try to protect the children. But I was pushed around on every side by disrespectful, intrusive people. I was in a lot of emotional pain. But for a short time, I tried to take charge. I guess it's my nature to try to be responsible and to organize chaos. But in this case, maybe that was a bad thing to do. I got a lot of bad press for it later, but I only did it because I wanted to make things right for Florence. I finally gave up. I didn't go to the cemetery. I just got into my car feeling terrible and went home to grieve alone. Through the burden of my celebrity, I have learned certain ways to carry myself and my loads. I always try to see the bigger scheme of things, and in so doing find a form of grace with which to live my life. I often see myself as the keeper of the flame, and this is how I felt about Florence's light. I wanted to be the keeper of the flame for her. It doesn't always work. When Florence left the Supremes, we had immediate commitments, and we were minus one singer. We had to fill the space right away. Cindy Birdsong had been singing with Patti LaBelle in the Bluebells when we approached her. She was the same physical size as Florence. All the costumes fit her. She sang in the same key, and they had similar personas. When she first joined us, she was rather intimidated and sang very quietly. None of us really expected her to stay on as a Supreme. We thought that Florence was coming back, and Cindy would return to her former group. It turned out very differently. She ended up staying on until I left 3 years later. As we formed our new group, Barry took this opportunity to make an additional change. A separation had been brewing for a long time, in my opinion. It was a forced separation, one largely created by outside influences. I had been singing all the leads, and so the press had been singling me out from the other two girls. And then there were the fans. Instead of appreciating us as a unit, they kept picking out their favorite Supreme, saying this one is better than that one, and thereby pitting us against each other. In mid-1967, Barry officially changed the name of our group to Diana Ross and the Supremes. This was not my idea. It came from Barry. He discussed it in detail with Mary and me. It seemed inevitable. He explained to us that it would also be easier to demand more salary if we were a lead singer and a group. Instead of the pressure lifting, it only increased. Something had to give. With Cindy Birdsong as our newest Supreme, we once again hit our stride. We never restored the harmony and the excitement present when we first began. But over the next few years, Diana Ross and the Supremes were able to carry on, performing and recording some wonderful hits. Holland Doja Holland wrote many of them. When they finally made their decision to leave Motown, Barry put us with some new songwriters who wrote some different music for us. Among them were Love Child in September of 1968 and Living in Shame in 1969. I enjoyed these new songs. They had a wonderful sound, but for me they weren't as wonderful as the older Holland Doja Holland songs like Baby Love and Stop in the Name of Love. The lyrics were good, but those sweet romantic love songs were more real to me. It was the 60s, life was moving and everything had to change, our music included. Big changes were in the air, not only for the Supremes, but also for Motown. After Cindy joined us and we were once again immersed in the excruciating demands of our career, Berry Gordy undertook the task of moving Motown to Los Angeles. I had no idea how long he worked up to this move. It must have been years. Can you imagine what it took to relocate such a complex, intricate operation 2,000 miles away? Once again, Barry did it. Sometime around 1970, Motown, Barry, and I moved away from Detroit to start a new life in California. Mary and Cindy stayed behind because they didn't want to live in Los Angeles, and so the group dynamic became different. Instead of continuous rehearsals as we had before, we would get together to rehearse for specific tours and albums. I was just as glad because there was a great deal of internal jealousy then, and the girls were really taking it out on me. Barry loved living in California. He felt at home there almost immediately, and he seemed to thrive. This was when he officially signed the Jacksons to Motown. Through my relationship with Barry, I was able to meet Michael, a very special human being. When the Jackson 5 first came to California, they moved in with me. Despite the negativity that has been written about them, I knew them to be a unique family. Apart from meeting the Jacksons, I was sort of lost in California, just trying to learn my way around a little bit. Although I had traveled extensively with the Supremes, I had never lived anywhere but Detroit. Los Angeles, the city of angels, is so massive, so spread out. I had to rely on Barry most of the time. Of course, that was how he liked it. My increased dependence upon him only added to his ability to control and overpower me, which I allowed. So, there we were, Barry and I, not exactly living together, but in close proximity. I had rented a house down the hill from him. We never talked about marriage. I wasn't ready for that. He's 15 years older than I am, and he had already been married with 3 kids. Although he had focused so much attention on me throughout my career, I had never felt that he was serious about me as a woman or a prospective wife. I wasn't really even his girlfriend. At least he never called me that. But he used whatever he could find to keep me under his wing. I remember him telling me that he didn't want his female performers to fall in love with anyone else or get married because it would ruin their careers. He felt that the spouses would try to be the boss and try to become too involved with their work, and so that is why when I met Bob Ellis Silverstein, I kept it to myself. I met Bob in a men's clothing store on Santa Monica Boulevard. I was on my way to the Beverly Hills Health Club when this store caught my eye. I needed a birthday gift for someone and went in to take a quick look before my workout. And there he was, looking really great, dressed in a white tennis outfit. "Are you a tennis pro?" I heard these words pop out of my mouth. I had been thinking about taking tennis lessons, but still it surprised me when I spoke up. I was sort of shy, and here I was speaking to someone I didn't know, unusual for me. "No, I'm not," he answered. I smiled shyly and then slightly embarrassed that I had opened the conversation and not knowing what to say next, I left the store and started across the street to the gym. The next thing I knew, he was standing beside me, helping me cross through the busy Santa Monica Boulevard like a true gentleman. I was quite taken by him. He swung open the large glass door to the health club, and just as I was about to walk through, he stammered something. "Would you?" "No, probably not," he said. "What?" I encouraged him. "I was wondering..." He stopped again. "Wondering what?" "No, that's all right. Forget it. Well, you probably wouldn't want to go to a movie, would you?" "I might," I told him. We exchanged phone numbers. I couldn't believe I was giving this stranger my number. He called a few times, but because I wasn't home when he called, I avoided speaking to him. I think that some of the time we must have been on tour anyway. I wasn't sure that I should have given him my number. I was used to being under very tight security, but I was lonely, and I had always been so protected when I traveled. I never got a chance to meet anyone unless they were on the shows with us. I rationalized that working on my career was more important than dating and having fun. But Bob kept calling. I finally spoke with him a few times, and then we started dating. He introduced me to a different side of life. We had a lot of fun. I had been so overly protected in my career, and now here I was, flying down the street on the back of Bob's motorcycle, with the wind blowing through my hair, just as it did when I rode my bike as a child. And skiing, something that had been forbidden. After all, what if I broke my leg? With Bob, I threw caution to the wind. I felt free and alive. When things were good between us, I really enjoyed being married to Bob. He was an early riser, and he worked hard. These were qualities I really admired, and he loved to do things around the house. He was a good-looking man, and he loved good-looking cars and good-looking clothes. He wanted so much to be successful. He was a school teacher when I met him, and then he went on to become a manager in the entertainment business. We had a wonderful marriage for the first couple of years. But no matter how good things were, he felt he had to contend with the shadow of Barry Gordy. I hadn't told Barry about Bob right away, because even though Barry had plenty of other women, I knew he would discourage the relationship. It was something that I was doing that he couldn't control, and that would threaten him. When he learned that I was dating someone, he said he wanted to meet him. He treated it all quite innocently. It wasn't. Today, thinking back, he had his tactics. During the meeting, Barry was cordial and quite polite. Later, he had subtle ways of tearing Bob down. It seemed that the war was on. Barry and Motown showed up like jealous lovers. This may not be the way that it was, but it seemed that they didn't want me to be with anybody, and they kept making Bob wrong, showing me what he was not doing for me and not capable of giving me. It became a kind of tug-of-war. It was very demanding, and Bob got caught up in the competition. In the end, I guess Barry's fears were valid, because Bob was actually very influential in helping me make my decision finally to leave Motown. He was always pointing out how, in many ways, they were taking advantage of me, keeping me off guard and frustrated all the time. We both understood that they were also trying to help me, but I had given Barry and Motown too much control. The tensions between these two men in my life was high. I felt caught in the middle. Bob and I certainly had our share of difficulties, and as time went on, things kept getting worse and worse. I remember one awful night when everything came to a head. Bob and I had been married for maybe 6 years. We already had 3 girls. They were at home with the babysitter, and we were out riding in his Jeep. I don't know what the fight was about, but Bob was so angry with me that he started to speed and drive recklessly. He was that angry. Certain that we were going to have an accident, I yelled at him to stop the car. He did, and I threw the door open and got out. I knew that I had to get away from him. When I saw what Bob was capable of, that he could be careless enough to endanger my life, his life, and his children's future. I knew, in that moment, that our marriage was over. Bob was not an abusive man. That was never his pattern. He was just going through tremendous problems. And I have learned, unfortunately, the hard way, that I will not jeopardize my life and the safety of my family for anyone. This is what I have based many of my life-changing decisions upon. Bob and I have remained friends. He was a good person then, and he's a good person now. He's the father of my girls, and he and my girls are still very close. The decision to go out on my own began a long, tenuous road back to a different way of life, to a new city, to my film career, and eventually, a higher love. When it began, I could not know what was in store. I only knew that I was afraid, and I had to turn to my faith to get me through. My career and adulthood blossomed during the 30 revolutionary, exciting, violent, and daring years. While hope ran high, and astronaut Neil Armstrong took his first step on the surface of the moon, this was also a frustrating era of rage. Our hearts ached with grief as the leaders that we most admired and loved lost their lives to assassins' bullets. My personal world was filled with long hours in recording studios, exhaustion from being on tour, and the normal challenges of growing up, both in my life and in my career. While I was singing Stop in the Name of Love with the Supremes, our nation was plunging deeper and deeper into a war that many agreed our country should never have entered. So many kids rebelled by turning to drugs in order to escape a world that they thought was falling apart. I recall an uneasy stirring among women during this time. Housewives were no longer content to stand behind the stove and cook. 1968 marked the early beginnings of the feminist movement, the same time that blacks began to raise their fist in the Black Power salute. My life was touched personally by the Vietnam War, as were the lives of so many others because my brother Fred fought in Vietnam. He had strong feelings about his family and his duty to his country. I remember how much confusion he had when he was over there. He wanted to believe in the American dream, but he could clearly see that the war was meaningless. Many of his friends were dying of drug addiction, either in Vietnam or when they came back, and he had lost faith in nearly everybody. The events of the 60s had an effect on my choice as a woman, as a human being, and as a professional. Women's liberation had changed my way of thinking in every facet of my life, from how I handled my business affairs to my expectations in my personal life. My life and career were made easier by others who suffered indignities and stood up to certain abuse. I'm talking about such women as the great contralto, Marian Anderson, the gracious Lena Horne, the inspirational Ethel Waters, the fragile and vulnerable Dorothy Dandridge, and the brave and exotic Josephine Baker, and scores of others, Billy, Bessie, Sarah, and Ella. The civil rights movement also had a profound effect on me. I was invited to perform at Sun City, a segregated township in South Africa. They were willing to pay me large sums of money to perform there, but I declined. Arthur Ashe had told me about that place, that apartheid was active there, and along with many other empathetic performers, I took a stand. I refused to be exploited. Much change had been initiated during the 60s, but there was still tremendous unrest. We had lost faith in the systems that we thought could protect us. When the decade ended, our youth was restless. No one knew what was next, but we were no longer willing to hide behind our dreams. As a nation, we were committed to speaking out and to looking at reality, no matter how harsh it might be. In my own life, change was also happening, and I was committed to letting it happen. I also had changed. The farewell performance of the Supremes took place in January 1970 at the Frontier Hotel in Las Vegas. Everybody was there. I was waving goodbye to a dream. I never like to say goodbye. I'll see you soon, maybe, but Never goodbye. Goodbyes are too final. That night in the dressing room, we tried to act as if this was just another show, as if things were okay, business as usual. But nothing was usual, and things were not okay. I stared at my face in the mirror, applying my makeup, fixing my hair, with this large lump in my throat. I kept pushing the tears down, trying to swallow, holding on to myself so that I wouldn't break apart. I stayed silent as I thought about what had happened to us. Saying goodbye to the Supremes was very difficult, because I had worked so hard for the success of the group. I had made many personal sacrifices to promote the name, to keep the unity, to sing the songs, and to travel. Now it was time to go. We just didn't fit anymore. I didn't take anything with me, not the gowns and costumes or the name. I left all that with Mary and Cindy for the forming of the new group. I had to take this risk. The girls had treated me badly. They blamed me, acted as if everything was my fault, that the press hadn't written about them, that Barry had chosen the songs that he wanted me to record. They were so blinded by jealousy, they never stopped to think that maybe, just maybe, my voice was better suited for the songs that Brian, Lamont, and Eddie wrote, that our records were selling because of my sound. It was inexplicable to me, but that's the way it was. I had been tormented, treated as if I was invisible, talked about behind my back when my back wasn't even turned, and yet I had tried to continue. I had tried to perform and pretend that all was well. When they had finally become so angry that they stopped talking to me, it was too much to endure. So I made a decision. I had been given the opportunity to do the film about Billie Holiday. At first, we were considering that my leaving the Supremes would only be a trial period. Then I thought more about it, and it didn't make sense, not for me or for them. The rehearsal period for the film was approaching. That would take a considerable amount of time because a great deal of dedication would be necessary on my part to understand the music and the complexities of the woman whom I was to play. Then the shooting would begin after that, and I was pregnant. That would force the girls not to work for much too long, not singing or making any money. It wasn't fair to them. The separation had to be permanent. That night, as I prepared to perform with them for the last time, I knew that the decision was one I had to stay with. Things had gone too far. It had become impossible for me to record with them any longer. I was underweight and sickly because the negative energy had overwhelmed me. Most of the time, I was too upset to eat. I guess some of this may be hard to comprehend from the outside. Our kind of life looks so glamorous and beautiful that everyone wants to do it. When the opportunity comes, it's different than you think. There's so much more to it than just putting on a pretty gown, getting on the stage, and singing. There's learning about the business itself, which cannot be overlooked or pushed to the side. And you have to be a quick study, or someone will rip you off. Although I was fearful on the outside, deep within I knew that I was okay. As a child, I always believed I had a guardian angel, and I prayed to her every night. She had been with me then, and she was still with me. I had been raised with a good sense of values. I had learned from everything, what my parents taught me, what happened in the streets, what I saw in my travels. Although I may not have fully understood this, I was already well equipped for the next phase. It was time to grow up. All I needed to do was trust myself. Trust, the ongoing theme of my life. The curtain opens. The show is supposed to be happy. We are singing our greatest hits, but I feel deeply sad. I'm smiling and singing the words to the songs that everyone knows so well. The upbeat lyrics of my youth, but my heart is crying. We close the evening with one of our most powerful songs, Someday We'll Be Together. I never like to say goodbye. When I first started singing, the thought of being an actress and making movies had never crossed my mind. My solo career began quite well, and I figured I would keep on singing. After all, that's what I love to do. When the announcement was made that I would be playing Billie Holiday, my mere acceptance of the role sparked a great deal of criticism. People said I didn't look like her, I didn't sing like her, I hadn't lived like her, and I hadn't experienced what she had. We hadn't even begun shooting, and the press had already turned against me. I tried to just get past it and do the best I could in the role. After all, it was to be a movie, not a documentary. For a public figure, enduring unfounded criticism is a necessary evil. As hard as it is to accept, I have learned not to be stopped by it. I guess, once again, I've learned the hard way because I've been criticized so much. My experience has taught me not to personalize what I read in the press, but ultimately, it's only a part of the music or a scene in a film that people are finding fault with, not me as a human being. As you know by now, dwelling on the positive has been the motivating force in my being able to grow and learn as an entertainer and as a human being. A positive attitude, dedication, and my determination have been the tapestry of my life. But it seems with every achievement, with every move I have made, no matter how great or small, someone was always there to try to bring me down. I have been criticized every step of the way. I have been called names, my music has been ridiculed, and my movies taken apart. This has been true as far back as I can recall. When I was a child, I remember how I practiced and practiced to be in a school play. A teacher I had discouraged me. He was very condescending. I think that subtle put down made me want to prove him wrong. Dealing with Mary Wilson's book was a journey in which lightness triumphed over darkness. I was depressed for a while, but as I have said, I don't hold on to bad feelings. I loved Mary. She and I started out as good friends. That's what I remember most. My love for her didn't end one day because she wrote a book. I have forgiven Mary. She was my dear friend, and I never stopped loving her. But I had to let go of her. It hurt too much. Forgiving someone doesn't necessarily mean I have to be with that person. I wish Mary only good things in her life, but I no longer consider her a friend. It was very hard for me to make a final emotional break from Mary, but it had to be done. I never stand still, because if you're not moving forwards, you're probably moving backwards. I don't ever regret loving, even if it didn't turn out well. I have always looked at the positive qualities of criticism. Constructive criticism helped me grow. Difficult encounters and adversity usually can be a type of learning, inspiring change. Throughout my life, I have tried not to let disappointment get me down. I've cried over many articles written about me, but I move on and I don't hold on to that. Someone once said to me, "You don't have a wrinkle on your face." And I said, "Not yet." But that's because I don't hold on to anger or disappointment. And that has helped me not to have any guilt or regrets about leaving the Supremes or getting a divorce or anything else I've been criticized for doing in my life. I guess it's also called peace of mind. When you have done your best and what you thought was right, then you can live with yourself and others. It was especially difficult to ignore the criticism in the case of my first film because it tapped into my own deepest fears. Since I had no previous acting experience, this was a process of blind trust, of real effort, of believing in myself, trusting my instincts, and taking a leap of faith. I would have to jump right in and go for it and block out all the rest. I remember speaking with an acting coach at the very beginning of our rehearsal period and confiding in him. "I've got to do this film, and I don't know the first thing." I'll never forget what he said to me. It made all the difference. "You'll do fine," he said. "Just don't be afraid to make mistakes and trust yourself. There's no wrong way to act. Be real and honest, and above all, don't be afraid to make a fool of yourself. This was the most important advice anyone could ever give me, because the role was extraordinarily demanding in so many ways. In order to play this part, I was literally against the wall to dissolve all the images that everybody had about me. I found out that if I was afraid to look stupid, I would never learn anything. So I had to close my eyes and just do it. Barry really believed that I could be a great actress. I've always said if one person believes in me, I would try to move mountains. I fought really hard to do what he believed I could do. I have been fortunate in my life. In my youth, my mother took the supportive role of believing in me unconditionally. And then it was my elementary school teacher, Miss Page. Later, Barry took over. With that kind of support, I think we can do anything. When I made the decision to do the movie, I had just become pregnant with my first child, Rhonda. I had always wanted to be a mother, and I remember thinking, I can't do this film because I'm going to have a baby. The film kept getting delayed, as they often do, and I used my 9 months of the pregnancy to read whatever I could about Billie Holiday, about drugs, and about drug addiction. I studied everything that related to the film that I could get my hands on. This was a perfect time for research. As often happens with first pregnancies, I got sick a lot, and I didn't go out much. I took the opportunity to listen to Billie Holiday's music. What I mostly heard was a tremendous pain coming from deep inside of this talented woman. But I don't think the pain was part of her natural being. I think the pain came from her drug addiction. Because it was absent from her earlier performances, the ones she did before she became drug addicted. When the pain was not present, what was left was a very interesting and unique sound. Even when she was older and her voice had begun crackling, if you listen carefully beyond the crackling and the pain, that incredible sound was still there. During my 9 months of intense research, I had some important decisions about how I would interpret the role, one of them being that I would not try to sound like Billie. That felt like the wrong approach. My voice was so different from hers, I would work on bringing through my own sound. Strangely, since I listened to almost nothing else during that time, I took on the same phrasing she used, and in this way, I ended up sounding a lot like her after all. Right after I had my baby, and just before we began the actual filming of the project, we recorded the songs. I had already been working with the script, or at least an early version of it, so I could see where in the unfolding story each song would be placed. That was a great help to me, because I could determine whether Billie was going on drugs, all the way addicted, coming off, or drug-free during each particular song. Her relationship with drugs at each specific phase in her life created a difference in how the song was to be interpreted, musically and emotionally. I was basically treated with a great deal of respect and trust by the people involved in the making of the film. I was pleased that they would let me watch the dailies, the footage that was shot the day before, as this helped me to see how I was doing, and I felt good about how things were progressing. But it was a very hard time. I had to throw myself into Billie Holiday's life, and her existence was riddled with pain and suffering. In a very short period of time, I lived Billie Holiday's toughest moments of a very tough life. Maybe I didn't live them exactly as she did, because I never did drugs, but I vicariously learned some of her hardest lessons, and these lessons have become a part of the fabric of my own life. Things like the price you pay for being out of control in love, or being overly vulnerable where it isn't safe, both in life and in business, and caution against susceptibility to drugs. That's about the addiction to the highs. It's about being on stage and the highs are so high. The lights, the applause, the adoration. Then the performance is over and you go home and you're on the road and you're all alone in a strange hotel room somewhere. You want to escape that. You want the lights, the power, the energy. You want to keep the high, to stay in that exalted moment, to be excited all the time. But that can't be. What you really need in life is balance. Not too low, not too high, just somehow to stay easy in the middle. There's a balanced way to sleep, to eat, even to drink. To upset the balance is to get off track. And it's dangerous. For me, my kids have always helped me to keep my sense of balance. When they cry for Mom, I don't have time to be Diana Ross. Finally, what I receive from playing Billie Holiday is a richer part of myself. The music was so rich with emotion and feeling. I liked the places within myself to which I needed to go to perform the songs. So I started selecting songs for my own performances that would pull more from me in a much deeper place. I was able to use my work as therapy, as I did a few years later when I filmed The Wiz. I seem to always be able to use my work that way, especially when I'm performing. I can sing it out really loud from my toes to the top of my head, and then I can just get over whatever it is that's bothering me. I had the great honor of being nominated for an Academy Award for my role in Lady Sings the Blues. It was doubly exciting because it was my first acting endeavor. Although I didn't win, it didn't matter. I was thrilled to have been given the opportunity to pay tribute to such an exceptional black woman and such a wonderful singer. In the summer of 1977, when I was first beginning the rehearsals for the part of Dorothy in The Wiz, I felt lost. I was no longer certain about where to be. I had left Detroit for L.A. and L.A. for New York, trying to find my place. I asked myself over and over again, where's my home? Detroit? Where I knew the surroundings, where I had family? It had certainly felt more like home. There had been love overflowing, but I didn't live there anymore. I hadn't lived there for quite some time. Was the Motown family home? It had been my creative center for 17 years, a place where I was nurtured, where I had worked hard and long. Even when things were difficult, I knew I had a special place there. What about the life I had built in L.A. with Bob? That had felt like home, especially since it was where my children had been born. Something there had changed. Bob and I weren't the same. We had grown in different ways. We had tried to mend the marriage, but we were having so many problems. The pressure of Bob's trying to overcome Berry Gordy's importance in my life was too much. I felt torn apart all the time, not happy with Bob, not happy with Barry, not happy at Motown. It was a painful time for me. I tried kidding myself that I could find a way to make it all work, but I knew that I would eventually have to leave them both if I wanted to find peace. I would have to change everything to start over, to wash it all away. I tried coming to New York to be away from it all. I really did still love Bob, and I thought that time apart might save us, giving us time to think and giving him a chance to sort out some things. But that didn't happen. We couldn't start again. I had to face the truth that it was over. I finally flew to California to get my divorce, and when I returned, I knew that I was alone, truly alone. I felt just like Dorothy, lost in some faraway land, trying to live in the I don't know what's next, trying to trust that I would be fine. I kept my house in Los Angeles, but I rented a friend's apartment in Manhattan until I decided whether or not I was going to look for something more permanent. At least my children were with me, and that kept my mind off myself. I enrolled them into school for September. That was when we were scheduled to start shooting the film. My mom came to give me a hand with my girls and to help me start organizing my life, which included my financial affairs. Something I hadn't taken the time to understand. I had left a lot of that to Barry and Motown, and that was part of the problem with Bob, who had explained how stupid that was. This was one more area I had to change, one more thing that I had to learn from scratch. I was determined to do it clean, to start fresh without the old pain, not holding on to any unhappiness or anger. And so I looked around, and here I was, on my own in New York, overwhelmed with the newness of it all. Was this home? This big city with so much noise and commotion? It felt so impersonal, how could I ever call it home? And yet, somehow, I knew that it was up to me, that I needed to make it real, that I needed to create it here for myself and my girls. This was to be my initiation into taking responsibility for myself. As I dived headlong into my new film project, I began to realize an incredible connection between my life and Dorothy's. The sheltered girl who suddenly finds herself in a strange land without any of her old friends. All new frames of reference. Nothing familiar. And her task is to find her way home, both physically and metaphorically. This role was to be a great gift to me, as it so closely resembled the role I was living in my life at the time. My search for the inner workings of Dorothy's being, for the answers to her deepest questions, was truly the search for my own questions and longings. They were one and the same. Somewhere deep inside, Dorothy always knew that she would prevail. And in my new life, so did I. It was about trusting in something you couldn't see, at times a difficult mission. Starting right from the beginning, there was a lot of help and guidance along the way. While poring through the vast Oz material that I had gathered for my research, I discovered a great gift. It was an annotated version of Frank Baum's The Wizard of Oz. During my study of this manuscript, some of the previously disjointed pieces started fitting together. I began clearly to see the possibility that everything occurring in Dorothy's dream was a direct reflection of her life. Her pain that was crying out for attention, the unresolved areas that she needed to learn to define, to handle, to care for, to work on, so that she might grow and be fulfilled as a whole person. And once again, I saw that the process was the same for me. And so, as I blew into the strange new world of New York, my life was full and busy. I was occupied with two major tasks: setting up a comfortable place to live for my girls and me, and the research on my character. Fortunately, both of these took off quite well. My kids began to attend their new school, and almost immediately, I saw incredible progress in them. I think it was due to the fact that they were feeling more secure and had more of me than they had had in California. That was important for them and for me, too. In truth, we all needed each other. The Manhattan apartment that Rhonda, Tracy, and Chutney and I were staying in was very small, especially compared to my house in Beverly Hills, and yet it worked to our advantage, proving to be exactly what we most needed. We were able to live more privately, because we didn't need a large staff to take care of things, as we had in Los Angeles. So a bonding took place between my girls and me that I do not think would have otherwise been possible. New York City is so full of energy and things to do, it is an ideal place to stay busy and not feel sorry for yourself. I was not looking for a husband then, but I was looking for friends. Sidney Lumet, the director of The Wiz, became a very good friend to me, and he used to give wonderful dinner parties. He introduced me to a lot of his New York friends, and life became fuller and more interesting. I did whatever I had time for to immerse myself into the culture and bustle of New York. I went to the movies, and then sometimes I would go out dancing at Studio 54, a very trendy club owned by my friend Steve Rebell. This was a place where I could completely let myself go into the sound of the music. When I wasn't dancing, there was a special place where I would sit above the whole scene and watch what was going on. I also went to dinner parties with other celebrities like Liza Minnelli, Halston, Iman, many other beautiful models, and Andy Warhol, and various decorators and designers. Although I knew what was going on, I was not aware of the drug scene at that time. I have been very lucky in my life to be able to steer myself away from drugs and the people who were involved with them. The music, the dancing, the aliveness, that was what attracted me. I loved that aspect of the nightlife, but I was not a party animal. Most nights, after I put my kids to bed, I would read self-help materials, anything I could get my hands on to forget my pain and to try to understand myself better. I stayed busy so that I wouldn't have time to think, but in actuality, I was making life decisions, finally to be alone and to start over again. Even though The Wiz was disappointing at the box office, it was a huge success in my life and in the lives of many of the other people involved. Making the movie when I did helped me to work through a lot of difficult times and to make many important decisions. I had to straighten out my life to figure out things that were new and confusing. I was getting my strength both as a woman and a performer. The long-suffered emptiness within me was filling up. And by the time the film was done, I, like Dorothy, had found that everything I was searching for was right here with me all along.
The first level under what you see on the stage, under the stage, backstage, behind the curtains, under the rug, in my heart, losing myself, finding myself.
Leaving Motown was a profound experience. The truth is that I did not leave Motown because I was upset or angry or hurt. I left because I was growing as a person and it was time for me to move on. In the spring of 1980, Nile Rodgers and Bernard Edwards, a very talented songwriting team, sat down with me to talk about my career and what was happening in my life. My recording of I'm Coming Out was the result of that meeting. It was released in August of 1980 and was a true reflection of my feelings then. I can't say that I had a premonition that I was getting ready to leave Motown. In fact, I did not. But I knew that I was getting ready to change in a big way. You know the feeling when you're unhappy, and although you don't know what's about to happen, you know that things can't go on the way they are. That was how it felt for me then. Perhaps my music is part of what has clued me in when these changes are beginning. At some point in my career, it began to feel as if the music and I were one. Either the songs were following me around, or I was following the songs. In 1980, just prior to my leaving Motown, I had three big hits, two of which were directly expressing my life. I'm Coming Out was the first one, then 1 month later they released It's My Turn, a beautiful song written by a great songwriter named Michael Masser. It's My Turn became very important to me. Apparently, I wasn't the only one who felt this way. After it was released, I heard from a lot of other women who told me that they strongly connected with that particular song. They must have been in the same position I was in because they would say to me, "Were you really going through the same things I was going through at the time?" "Probably so," I would answer. It was a collective experience. Go on out there, sing your songs, wear your gowns, look pretty, we'll do the rest. That was basically the message Motown was always giving me. As I followed their directives, I was stagnating. I got caught up in the mode of allowing everybody else to take care of my life. After all, they had made it so easy. They did my finances, they paid my taxes, they bought my house, and I never had to figure out any of these things for myself. It was a seductive lifestyle. Somewhere in there, I decided that enough was enough. I felt that I had to start doing for myself. When you make a film, you have a director. He tells you what to do and you act accordingly because he's supposed to see the big picture. Well, that might work in a film, but life is not a movie. Human beings have minds of their own. We are not puppets to be pushed and pulled at someone else's whim. Even before my divorce, I was learning and getting wiser. I was really starting to change. And so was Barry, not necessarily for the better. He had the same sharp mind he always had, but he had begun to act like a genius gone mad. He had always been a dominating person, but his control issues were escalating. He was reaching the place where he was always right and everybody around him was wrong. He made it unbearable for me, and so he became, for me, an instrument of change. I walked away from a 20-year relationship with Motown, with very few material assets. Barry built Motown from scratch, and whatever he was earning, he put right back into the business. In this way, he was putting our money back into us. He paid for our training, the finishing schools, the artistic development programs he set up to train us. Everyone was able to travel and to see the world. Motown was a family experience, and it gave us things that our real families couldn't. The money for all that had to come from somewhere, especially in the beginning, when a hit song paid almost nothing compared to how it works today. But I wonder, if Barry hadn't pushed us, if he hadn't made us work, would we have stuck with it? I don't think so. I really don't. And so I never felt ripped off. For me, I think it all balanced out in the end. When I left Motown, in my heart I said, okay, we're even. And I really meant it. I left happy to have been a part of a wonderful dream. The 80s were about creating a brand new life. I spent most of it alone, being a single parent to my girls. I was truly not looking for a man. I did enjoy some companionship with men I dated off and on, but a husband was out of the question then. I was too busy soothing past pains, healing old wounds, and finding a new direction for my career. This entire cycle of renewal lasted 9 years, starting with my divorce from Bob until I met Arna in 1984. Although I had begun the task of taking responsibility for my life, it deepened greatly during this period. I had been singing for more than 20 years, and although I knew a great deal about the ins and outs of performing, there were so many areas in my life which I was a novice. I decided to change that, and so I used this time to educate myself by learning more about the things that I had neglected over the past 2 decades, particularly business and finances. In 1980, I went full swing into business for myself. I think the real estate has been my best investment to date. I bought an office building in New York, 5 floors of which I used to create my companies, N8 Films, Ross Records, Rosstown, Ross Publishing Company, and my own financial department called RTC Management. I kept the building for 2.5 years, then I sold it for a good profit. I moved my offices into a smaller space after learning that I needed fewer people to make my organization work than when I began. I have become a good negotiator because I'm not afraid to talk about money. Over the years, I have made a lot of mistakes, but I'd rather not blame anybody. I'd rather be personally responsible for not having had the knowledge at the time. I know many celebrities and show business people who hand their financial matters over to someone else. I would rather learn and do it myself. Knowledge is power. My first record deal after I left Motown was with RCA. I was given the opportunity to completely produce my own records, from finding the musicians to setting up studio time, mixing, mastering, laying the music onto the tracks, finding the engineer, overseeing the photographs, creating the title, doing the colors for the cover, choosing the costumes, the names, the liner notes, every single ingredient. It was a magnificent learning experience. When I initially moved to New York, it was a time of letting go of many loose ties. Sadly, this included friends and people I loved, especially the people who had supported me in my career and helped me to build my wonderful life. But I had to let it go. It was time for me to move on from them, and I found that tremendously painful. Being a single parent was not hard for me. It became an incredible release because I didn't have to answer to anyone. This was a new and much desired state of being for me at the time. I was on my own raising my girls, and so I was free to make my own choices and to do what came to me naturally. This wonderful gift of being a celebrity carries a heavy burden. Problems, intrusions, becoming a thing to overcome for my children. My career has pushed me into the public life. I enjoy it very much and I try to handle it with grace. I want to be the kind of public figure that people respect. At the same time, my privacy is very important to me. I have often thought how hard it must be for children to hold their mother as a precious gift in their lives when they must first overcome the fame. Children must have their own individuality and independence. It is sometimes a difficult task. I remember when my oldest daughter, Rhonda, was much younger, and she used to go away to summer camp. I missed her very much, and she didn't want me to visit, but I knew it was important for her to go. I tried to teach my girls to talk about their feelings, not to hold on to anger or upset. If I do something they don't like, my children will tell me, "Mama didn't like it when you did that," or, "Mama really don't want you to come to my class because it's very important that people recognize me and care about me for who I am, not because I'm Diana Ross's daughter." I'm mature enough to understand that, but sometimes it causes me great sadness because I want to share more in their lives. When I walk into a gym to watch them do gymnastics or play basketball, the attention in the room gets directed at me. That is bothersome not only to me but also the girls. We try to be sensitive to each other to work it all out. I think we've done a pretty good job. I think my career was a positive force in raising my three daughters. I'd like to think it made me a better mother because I was satisfied with my own life and that I could encourage them to follow their personal destinies. I also think I was a positive role model in showing them how to balance commitments between work and family. I am extremely proud of all three of my daughters. Rhonda graduated from college in 1993 with honors. Tracy's doing well and graduates next year, and Chutney has just begun her freshman year in university. I'm so glad I had my children. I came from a large family. My parents had six children, and I always loved kids and wanted lots of my own. I had many girlfriends who decided they were going to work on their careers and have their babies later in life. Then later got later, and they didn't have any children. I was very picky about the projects I took, so my work would not interfere with having children. That's one thing I'll never regret, having my babies. I could not have gone this far in my career and returned home to an empty house. I'm more of a mother than I am a celebrity. Although living in New York can be wonderful and exciting for a single woman, I felt it was a frightening place to raise my kids. Right from the start, I knew that the apartment and the city were temporary. After about a year, I began to look for a real home in a lovely place that would be close to nature with living trees and grass instead of apartment buildings, concrete, and taxis. I didn't want to have to travel 2 or 3 hours to get back and forth, so it would have to be somewhere close, just on the outskirts of the city. That way I would have easy access to the city when I needed it, and yet I would still have a healthy place to raise my children. I wanted the best of both worlds. When I first saw my future home, it was the grounds and the trees that spoke to me. In fact, as beautiful as the house is, I never even went inside until I had walked the grounds. I was entranced. I felt an instant communion with nature there. I love being close to nature, a passion that turns out to be one of the strongest connections between me and my husband, Arna. Some of my most electrical and life-altering experiences have happened in the rain. The performance in Central Park, and the first time I met my husband. Arna is a businessman in the deepest sense. To hear him speak about our meeting sounds quite factual. To me, it was an exquisite scene from a movie. Romance, passion, sparks, and lightning. They say the truth is always more interesting than fiction could ever be. In this case, it was certainly so. Setting. The scene opens in Nassau, a perfect tropical island for man meets woman. I had been touring, and I needed to spend some time with my kids. It was to be a short trip, a little swimming in the day, and lots of sleeping in the night. A great way to rest, unwind, and be with my girls. My girlfriend Joanne came with me for companionship. The thought never crossed my mind that fate might have something very powerful in store. Weather conditions, rain, rain, and more rain. I was, needless to say, a little bit disappointed. Arne Næss, a Norwegian businessman living in London, had just returned from climbing Mount Everest, a worthy adventure for the hero in any story. He also wanted to be with his kids. So from opposite sides of the world, we met in this rain-drenched paradise. The scene opens around a swimming pool. Rain pouring down, the kids playing in the pool, oblivious to the weather. Splashing around, they instantly made friends with a few other children. Mine are too young to be alone, so I have to be there watching. Wearing a big hat to keep the rain off my face, I drag a chair under a small balcony and sit beneath it. I stay there slightly bored and detached, watching my kids, and suddenly there is a man walking towards me. I don't even look up, knowing he will sit beside me as there is no other place to find shelter from the rain. He moves another chair under the balcony and quietly sits. I realize that these other children are his. As he seems intent on watching the children, I get up and return to my bungalow. I don't even look up to see his face. The scene shifts. The six children end up in my bungalow, sitting on the floor playing Monopoly. This is normal. I've always been a magnet for children. So here we all are in Nassau, on a supposedly sunshiny vacation, stuck inside all day. The kids, of course, are unconcerned about the weather. There are one boy and five girls, and they are all getting along famously. Suddenly, the first miracle happens. The sun pushes its way through the dense cloud covering and emerges. Warmth and light enter the scene, and Nassau begins to resemble the tropical paradise they depict in the travel brochures. The kids rush out to the beach with Joanne. I enjoy the quiet solitude for a short while, and then I go out to join them. I never make it there. As I walk towards the beach, they are already walking back. The man from under the balcony is walking back with them, and for the first time, I see his face. I like what I see. "You've been with the children most of the day," he says to me. "Why don't I take them out to dinner?" "Fine," I say. "That sounds good to me. Joanne and I want to go out gambling tonight, and now we can." When destiny has something in store, it uses all available tools to achieve its end. The rains come down once again, and I watch my children dress to go out to dinner with another family. Perhaps I am prompted by unseen forces. I suddenly know exactly what I want to do. I say to Tracy, "Joanne and I have decided not to go out gambling. It's raining too hard. Would you go and ask the gentleman if we could also join him for dinner?" The answer comes back yes. Another shift in the action. A new scene. I let them go to dinner without me. I will meet them soon. Just before I leave, I realize that the dress that I have chosen has a long row of tiny buttons all the way down the back. I can't button them by myself. Oh, well, no bother. I'll let Tracy do it for me as soon as I get there. New setting. I jump into a little go-kart and arrive at the private club in Lifer Key. So beautiful. The perfect spot for the climax of the scene. I walk in the door looking for Tracy, and Arne jumps up. He instantly charms me. He's wearing a bow tie that I adore. He comes over to greet me. I smile. "Oh, you didn't have to wait for me," I say. "You guys could have started. I was just going to join you." He smiles and motions that it's okay. He doesn't mind. I hang back a moment and then say to him with a little blush, "I can't button my dress. Could you ask my daughter Tracy to come out and help me?" Without hesitation, he says, quite matter-of-factly, "I'll do it." Three little words. I don't know why I'm allowing this, but before I know it, I am turning around, piling my hair on top of my head with my hands, and a stranger is buttoning my dress. He starts at the top, As he clumsily tries to do up the tiny buttons with his big fingers, I realize that the buttons go clear down to my bottom. He reaches the middle of my back very slowly. He's having trouble with the size of the buttons, and my flesh is beginning to stand out in goosebumps. I feel strange now. "It's really all right," I tell him. "I can have Tracy do the rest." But this is the man who has just climbed Mount Everest. He is no quitter. He makes his way all the way down. He is finally finished. I let loose my hair, and we walk into dinner together. Another perfect set. He has taken a large round table in the center of the room, of the most elegant dining room. As I approach the table, the seating arrangement, which I expect happen randomly, seems to suggest a strange pattern. Beneath beautiful crystal chandeliers, Joanne, Arna, and the bigger girls are grouped together, almost according to age. The smaller girls come next, giggling amongst themselves, and then finally the boy, Christopher. Arna seats me beside him. We began to talk. And then suddenly the special effects began. The entire scene around me fades out. Seating patterns, giggling girls, waiters, all float weightlessly in the air around us. The scene is now a two-shot, Arna and I. I am completely fascinated with Arna Ness, the man who has just climbed Mount Everest. He speaks openly and honestly while we have a beautiful dinner and sip white wine. Suddenly, the rest of the world rematerializes. Dinner is apparently over and the kids are saying, "Let's go." As I float out of the restaurant, still caught in the enchantment, it occurs to me that he knows nothing about my career or who I am. His daughter has said to him, "Don't you know who this is? It's Diana Ross." He thinks he remembers seeing me perform somewhere, but he really isn't sure. I think he has seen me a long time ago with the Supremes, but never on my own. The magic isn't over. The next morning, before he leaves, he and his kids stop over to say goodbye. He's wearing khaki pants and a khaki shirt. He has brought a camera, and we all pose for Polaroid pictures. Now comes miracle number two. First he stands with all the kids, and then I do. When we look at the pictures, they look like family groupings. Eerie. We exchange numbers. I tell him, "If you're ever in New York, please call me." And he says, "If you're ever in London, do the same." I still have the vision of him walking away and saying to myself, "I'm going to see this guy again." I keep my photograph. In fact, I still have it. There the scene ended, but the energy did not. A short time later, the exact timing escapes me, I received a phone call. It was from Arna. "I will be passing through New York on my way to California. I just wonder what your plans are. Because maybe we can have lunch or dinner or something." I was also going to L.A. We could meet there. Excited, I agreed to dinner. We went to Jimmy's. We were having a pleasant enough conversation about who he was and who I was, the regular getting-to-know-you stuff, when he suddenly took his finger and brushed it lightly across the top of my hand. Just a gentle touch, and one of the most sexual sensations I have ever had. Startled, I yanked my hand away and gasped, "Why'd you do that? Why did you do that?" I repeated myself because I was so nervous. We had been in the most innocent conversation, and the sudden shift into sensuality had taken me by surprise. Perhaps it was a surprise for him, too. When the evening was about to end, Arna said, "I have to fly to New York, but I want to come back to California to see you again." Again, he surprised me. "You mean you're going all the way to New York and then you want to fly all the way back here?" I ask in disbelief. "Yes, if we can have dinner tomorrow night." You know what the answer was. We married soon after that. We both shared the feeling of wanting to get on with the rest of our lives. We didn't have time for courting and all the rest of it. We just went for it. Arna and I got married in Lausanne, Switzerland. although it was not the original location that I had wanted. We used to pass by a beautiful castle in Chillon along the drive from Geneva. It was a historical, magical place, and I remember saying to Arna, I would love to get married there. And he said, why don't we see if they have special occasions there? Maybe we can. We finally had to abandon the idea, but only after extensive checking and trying all kinds of ways to make it possible. That's what I love about Arna, his sense of romance and his attempts to do things in a special way to make every moment count. When I realized that I could not get the castle in Chillon, I searched for a small church around the same area in Geneva. I finally found a lovely old abbey in Lausanne. It seemed that once we had decided upon the place, everything else happened magically. Like preparing the invitations and finding the florists, I met a wonderful American woman living in Geneva who helped me plan the entire day. While I had been performing at Radio City Music Hall, there was a sweet baker who used to make me a special cake each night. I found him and commissioned him to make the wedding cake, a magnificent creation covered in jewels. Bob Mackey and Ray Aguillon at Elizabeth Courtney's makes the most beautiful gowns, so I couldn't imagine choosing anyone else to make my wedding gown. Over the previous 5 years, although I had no knowledge that I would be getting married, I had been collecting antique lace. I had my gown made of this beautiful lace. I wanted to wear white, but it is said that in a second marriage you're not supposed to wear white. I compromised with an eggshell cream color, and I wore a tiny diamond tiara that I had bought in Paris. It was old and delicate, a perfect match to the lace in the dress. I wanted a big wedding because I didn't have that when I married for the first time. Bob and I had eloped. We had quickly gone to Las Vegas, and we were married in a small chapel there. It had held its own kind of magic, but I had always dreamed of a large wedding, one to which I could invite all the friends, family, and loved ones of both my husband and myself. Unfortunately, it was too far for all my American friends to attend, but Steve Wynn flew over some of them in his plane, including Gregory Peck and his daughter. Arna was able to get the Norwegian boys' choir to sing at our wedding. They walked into the church holding candles, and their voices sounded as if they had come straight from heaven. I invited my American minister, Wentley Phipps, who sang a song that he had written especially for us. When I try to think of the words to describe the feelings of that day, I think of heavenly, magical, romantic, blessed. Arna and I were moved by the blending of our friends and families. Both our parents were there. My father was so proud of me. Not that I was marrying Arna, but simply proud of the things that I had accomplished in my life. It made him feel good about himself. After the wedding, we went on our honeymoon to Tahiti, where Arna owns his own island. It's very small but completely private, and we were like Adam and Eve running around naked. All I can say is we were very, very happy. The experience of my wedding was everything I had hoped it would be. It was the beginning of the magic that still runs through my marriage today. From the beginning of our marriage, Arna and I wanted to have a family together. Even though I knew it would be a great deal of responsibility for us at this time, I still wanted to have his child. That's a part of our relationship and the love I have for him. When Ross was born, there was a 12-year difference between my daughter Chutney and him. He would basically be growing up as an only child. I decided to have Evan because I wanted Ross to have a brother or a sister. I didn't know if that would prove difficult at my age, but my mother had always said that raising two is just like raising one. My two pregnancies were very close together, only 10 months apart. I knew that I had to be very careful. As a parent in her 40s, I had to take tests and examinations to make sure the babies were healthy. I did all the things I was supposed to do. I tried to eat right and stay active. I actually gained a lot of weight with Evan because I had intense cravings for Häagen-Dazs ice cream. But I lost it again, and we all turned out fine. Childbirth and having babies are the most magical times for me. Children give such special meaning to my life, and I often wonder what it would have been like if I had never had any. When my boys are grown, I might even adopt, because I love having babies around. I know that when the music is gone, when no one remembers Ain't No Mountain High Enough, my children will still be there. There is no way I could ever have chosen a career over my family and my children. Sometimes when my kids are asleep, I tiptoe into their rooms and just gaze at them. In these moments, I thank God for my life. I love my time at home knowing that my kids are in the other room, playing or sleeping. When you have babies, you realize that all these little guys know of life is what they pick up from you. So I try to be a good example. I work hard at being a good mother, and I feel that I am one. When they get older and I'm no longer around, I think they will remember that when they were sad or had a fever or a cold, Mom was there. Although I'm a very light sleeper and I can usually hear my children before they even get to my door, I always sleep with my door open so they can come in if they need me. The open door policy is something Arna had to get used to. When I am away, all of my children know they can phone me at any hour, any day, no matter where I am or what I am doing. No one on my staff or anyone else is allowed to stop them from getting to me. The boys don't understand yet why I sometimes have to be away overnight. When I'm on tour, we miss each other so much. I spend a lot of time flying back and forth just for the joy of walking into their rooms in the middle of the night to cover them up and kiss them. Even if I only have slept a few hours, I wake up early, have breakfast with them, and see them off to school. My family is my team. It hasn't always been easy balancing the many roles and demands of being a working mother and a wife, but the rewards are golden. As I raise Ross and Evan, I do everything in my power to keep them intellectually challenged, culturally stimulated, emotionally strong, happy young men. I try to teach them the golden rule as my parents gave it to me. I teach them to respect others and to treat all people fairly. I let them know they don't have to like everything about people to love them. My desire to be a positive role model for them is my inspiration to practice love in all the moments of my life, and I will try to live that way until the end of my life. I want to get my moment right, and I want my children to get their moments right. I try to teach my kids about forgiveness. This is something we all need to learn. Holding grudges acts like a slow disease or cancer that eats away at our souls. We must learn how to let go of anger and hurt, to forgive others and ourselves. I try to forgive all my mistakes, and when someone has hurt me in my life, I try to remember to send love. These are the things that I hope my children will learn from watching me. I have found thoughts and words to be the foundation for success and failure in life. I'm teaching my kids when to whisper and when to shout. Words often can hurt, especially between men and women. I want my children to understand how to use the power of words to bind them to others, not to divide them. I want my sons to have a healthy respect for women. I would like them to grow up knowing the joys of friendship and companionship between men and women, and to know that husbands are not meant to be fathers to their wives, but rather friends, lovers, buddies, and partners. I am confident that my sons will be strong in their values and a great source of pride for both Arna and me. Arna and I have been married for 8 years now. Despite our differences, we get along very well. But our living situation is a strain. He tried to get his business started here with me, but it was too difficult. His business moved to London and he went with it. I really don't think he expected me to follow. I love Arna very much, and we have the two boys, but I also have my girls, and I can't abandon one family for another. Arna understands this. He feels the same about his children. We both travel a lot, and that makes it hard on us. But I would find it hard just to be sitting at home waiting for my husband to come home and take me out to dinner. In my life, I need things to do and I need a purpose. I have to have something to get up for in the morning. I would find it difficult at this time to let go of my life here at home and move to Europe. Of course, I want to be with my husband, and he wants to be with me. And when we feel that, those are the difficult times. I feel that couples should not collapse into a marriage. You don't have to lose your identity or any part of yourself. When each person brings 100% into a relationship, the merging of those two people should give you 200%. Nothing lost, much gained. That's true synergy. Arne is a wonderful man who loves and admires my independence, as I do his. It is one of the things that first attracted us to each other. But it's this very same independence and commitment to our respective professions that sometime intrudes on our relationship. For the moment, we remain great jugglers as we struggle to balance our careers and family life. I have worked very hard to make everything mesh, but I know that if anything in my life falls between the cracks, it all comes back to how I handled a situation. Perhaps I did not pay enough attention to some small detail. I try to stay aware so that I don't miss anything, and I'm especially attentive to anything that affects my children. Arne has three wonderful children, Christopher, Katinka, and Leona. When we married, I was surprised that being a stepmother was not as easy as I thought it would be. I take well to most kids, and they usually like me, but I think that Arne's children had a normal reaction to the woman their father married. They must have felt that I was taking their father away from them. Of late, now that Arne and I have been married for more than 8 years, they have started being much more comfortable with me. It's about respect. Respect takes time. It isn't something that is there when you first meet people. It has to be earned. It takes authentic caring about each other. Because I travel so much, they have not had the time to feel my heart and to know who I really am. I face my marriage with the same positive attitude that I have tried to face all situations in my life. I feel the challenges that are in front of me. I've dealt with the past, and I'm excited about the future. I want to live each day completely. With love, all things are possible. As I look back, each step in my life was necessary and complete and perfect. Looking at my tapestry of life, the weaving of its threads, the color of the yarn, the textures, its flow and feel gives it its uniqueness that speaks only to me. If I touch it, it feels rough, soft, smooth, ups and downs, filled with lessons and decisions. The streets and apartments I grew up in, the voice that led me on my travels, and people and friends, my children and lovers, tightly woven into my cloth. My travels led me to where I am today. Sometimes these steps have felt painful, difficult, but led me to greater happiness and opportunities. I've learned through my pain and struggles. With writing these memoirs and remembering, I see that these were lessons of great importance. I know now that all these changes were probably meant to be its design, my special pattern. I realize I have learned from all my moments. Through it all, there has always been music. My purpose in life has been clear to me for a long time. It may change. Now I know I am here to serve and to help others, children in particular, and make a difference in the world. I've chosen these paths, or have they chosen me? The secret is, there's no secret.
This has been a Random House Audiobooks presentation.